Meeting of Government Operations and Elections Committee will come to order. Representative Hancock, did you have a chance to review the minutes?
I have, Madam Chair, and I would like to move the minutes of February 9th.
Okay, Representative Hancock has moved the minutes. Are there any corrections or discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of approval of the minutes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Minutes are approved. The first item on our agenda is House File 1954, and as Representative Downey is not on our committee, I will move that House File 1954 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Tax Committee. It's your bill, Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. If I could, I'd like to just give a quick description of the bill, and then I know there are some testifiers here who are part of the group that did some of the initial research that ended up in the bill. So if I could, I'd just walk through the bill and maybe suggest that they come forward and provide a more detailed explanation at that point. Last year's property tax blame game that we saw go on around the state of Minnesota, I think, highlighted a couple of things that this bill attempts to address, I believe, very fairly. And one thing that we saw is that citizens, I think, really struggle to understand what is driving their property tax increases, both in terms of what legislative body is actually responsible for those property tax increases and what actually is driving those tax increases. The second thing is that budget documents that are produced by local governments tend to be from the perspective of fiscal folks and financial people who are professionals in public sector financing, and they're largely unintelligible to the average citizen when they look at them. And as a result, oftentimes the truth in taxation hearings that are required are poorly attended. The information is really dense. Citizens feel they really have little influence, and since they occur typically after elections, I think their sense that the impact is limited is probably true. So this bill prescribes a very simple, straightforward, citizen-centric view of a local government's spending, and it does so in kind of two orientations. Traditionally, local government budgets are presented in terms of the program area, and this bill requires that they would do so by expenditure type, or as you kind of see the accounting-centric language here, by object code. So the bill says that not only should we see the budgets by program area, by parks, and by all the other things that cities do, but also by expense type, salaries and benefits and debt and contracts and materials and all those kinds of things. And so the bill is attempting to give a 1 to 2 page summary that citizens can actually understand to educate them about what really is driving the costs of their local governments. Very quickly, I'll walk you through the bill and then ask the testifiers to come forward if I could. This is for all counties and home rule charter or statutory cities with a population of 2,500 or more. That's in line 1.12 of the bill. If you move down to the real meat of the bill on page 6, section 3, starting in line 6.5, you'll notice that the expectation is that this information would be published electronically by September 30th, and then you'll look down and see that if electronic is not possible for that entity, they can do it manually by October 30th. And importantly, this is before Election Day, which I think is a nice feature. And what it requires is 4 years of data, the two most recently concluded budget years, estimated data for the current year, and then the projected data for the proposed budget in the upcoming year. And you can see the types of cost elements that are required as well when you get down into section or subsection C and D. We specifically exclude enterprise funds and fiduciary funds. Those have different kinds of interactions with the other general and other special revenue funds, and so those are excluded. And I make the point, members, that much of this information, if not all of it, is already being reported in some fashion on local government financial statements. They often are already reported in the exact same format by program area down in the appendices of the budget document. So all we're really asking for is a nice, concise, summarized version that the average person can understand, that not only shows what they're spending and where by program area, but what they're spending and how by the drivers of the costs in those program areas as well. And so with that, Madam Chair, I guess I'd be glad to answer a question if somebody has one about the bill itself, but it would probably be more helpful if we could, if the testifiers could come forward and explain what kind of went into building the bill in the first place.
I think I'd prefer to do it that way, then we can have more information before we move forward. I have a couple on my list here. Kay Rocco. Morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for taking time to listen to us today. My name is Kay Rocco, and I am the Director of Public Policy for NAOP, the Commercial Real Estate Development Association, representing commercial real estate developers and owners, along with the thousands and thousands of tenants in all of the buildings that our members own and manage. And the issue that galvanized NIOP's public policy efforts happened in the middle 80s when, through the actions of a number of different levels of government, more and more of the property tax burden was deliberately shifted to business properties. So since then, our focus has been very narrow, and we have focused on protecting and defending the business property taxpayer across the state. And most of our efforts have been focused on the state level. However, one of the things that I started to hear from our members over the course of the last couple of years was twofold. One is our property manager said to me, Kay, I know we're doing a good job at the state capitol. We're working hard to defeat proposed increases to the state general tax, but on a local level, our property taxes are going up. Isn't there something you can do about that? The other thing I started to hear came from leadership, from our public policy committee, and just members sort of hanging around the water cooler talking to each other, and they said, you know, we worked so hard on these property tax issues, why don't we ever get at the spending side? Why aren't we looking at where our dollars are going and what our dollars are buying? So our board of directors eventually said to us, get a group of NIOP members together, put a task force, and get smart on what causes local property taxes to go up and what are the cost drivers in local budgets. So we did. We put roughly 15 NIOP members together. We called ourselves the Nexus Task Force. And for a period of time, we spent a huge amount of effort having conversations with a variety of people. We talked to city managers, we talked to the League of Minnesota Cities, we had labor negotiators come in, we had city managers, council members, House fiscal staff came out and talked to us, we had legislators, there was a wide variety of people, and we tried really hard to understand Minnesota's complicated property tax system and the complicated financial relationship between the state and the cities, all which results in a lot of finger pointing and very difficult for ordinary citizens to understand. So we said, you know what, we just need to go to the basics. Let's take city budgets and let's dig into them and let's understand what the cost drivers are. And that's when we discovered that it is not easy to do that, because typically city budgets and county budgets are put together by program area and not by object code or by expenditure type. So if you want to know what the expenditure type is for any one item across the budget, you've got to go through 300 and some pages individually and add all those numbers up. So we decided before we can really go any farther with this, we would like to have cities present their budgets by object code in certain categories as well as the way they do it typically. We went to the board, we made our proposal, they said yes, and then ultimately we sat down with Representative Downey, and here we are today. Thank you. And now I'd like to turn it over to Paul Reinke, who chaired the task force. Paul?
I'm Mr. Reinke. Welcome to the committee, and just please remember to identify yourself for the tape.
Very good. Madam Chair and members, it's nice to be here this morning. My name is Paul Reinke. Do you want the address?
No, that's fine. Okay.
So I think I'm unique, and what's going on with me is that in my role, I live in two worlds, the professional and world as a real estate developer, commercial real estate developer in Minnetonka, primarily doing fee-based owner-occupied developments. On the personal side, I'm a taxpayer and second-term city council member in the city of Oakdale. Briefly, our small community is about 28,000 people, general fund budget about $11.2 million. Through this work with the Nexus Task Force, it's become very acutely aware that it's sometimes impossible to decipher for the average citizen or average taxpayer the cost drivers in the city budget. So the budgets are typically presented in, like you've heard, program and department detail. Sometimes they're presented in overwhelming detail, kind of the fire hose methodology. The initiative that's in the House Reform 2.0 package is really about the aggregating of the expenditures, and it's going to provide a couple of benefits to me personally and to my colleagues on the city, and also my my colleagues in the membership of NAIOP. I think from the role as a council member, I and my colleagues are going to be able to see and discuss that cost trend info resulting from our policies. We're going to see it in a different manner, and the implications of the decisions we make. I think we're also going to be able to engage the interested taxpayers in a more meaningful way. As Representative Downey suggested, and as maybe as you've experienced in your own tax and truth in hearing meetings, very few people come. And that I hope that this is going to help change that. From my role as a taxpayer, we're going to see the changes in the total expenditure categories. We're going to understand more the items that are driving these cost increases. And we're also going to obtain an increased understanding of the difficulties in running a city. Very few people can grasp the data that explains how cities are run. So at the end of the day, this initiative really isn't about asking for new information. As Representative Downey shared, this data is already in the city financial systems. And this is about organizing in a different manner, a more meaningful, transparent, and engaging manner. And it's just meant to provide information in the trend information to help taxpayers to increase their understanding. For the city of Oakdale, we present our information in program and department detail. We provide all the detail, that overwhelming detail. And this effort will also provide just one more element that will make it much more simple and much more meaningful for the taxpayer to understand. With that, I'll stand for questions, Madam Chair.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks to both of you. I know we had a very helpful and productive meeting in my district just at the beginning of session, and so I always appreciate the back and forth that we have. Now, I know that in the process, Ms. Rico had mentioned that there was a lot of research going on, and there was an attempt to understand the complexities of the property tax system and its relationship with cities, and you'd mentioned that you uncovered a lot of finger-pointing. And, you know, I think there's an essential issue here that I would love your commentary on, because I think a lot of the property tax issues in my city, and I think across the state of late, have to do with this very, very significant pattern of cutting local government aid. It's happened every single session that I've been here, and I know it's had a real impact on our property taxes. And I'm wondering, you know, in the course of your research, and I don't know if your association had lobbied specifically for that cut. I know the chamber had no issues with that and may have encouraged it, but what's the role of local government aid in all of this from your perspective? I mean, I have some thoughts and ideas, but as you talk to these various stakeholders, how much did this come up and how much is this a concern of yours?
Madam Chair, Representative Hornstein, first of all, our organization doesn't have a position on local government aid. We also recognize that it is one of the many pieces of the complicated property tax system. I will tell you that we had House research came in and must have spent an hour and a half explaining local government aid, and the members of the task force were so taken back by the complexity of that we just said, you know what, this is too complicated for us. So we decided to start to focus on the basics, which is looking at city budgets and understanding what the cost drivers are. And that's where we ended up, because everything else was just too complicated for a small group of ordinary people to weigh in on.
Representative Hornstein.
Manasha, I totally understand that. We've had to deal with all of these complexities as well, you know, as policymakers. But, you know, when we're looking at, you know, a third of the budget, you know, a fifth to a third of the entire budget, and then you're trying to look at efficiencies and ways to be taxpayer friendly, but then such a huge percentage of a budget is then just cut repeatedly over and over, you know, I think it's something that, even though it's complex, does need to be part of the equation as you look at this going forward. So complex, yes, agreed, but absolutely significant to I think what you're trying to get at, because this has just had a seismic impact on how local governments have approached taxation, have approached budgeting, and I think it's an unfortunate pattern that, you know, certainly I'm in my ninth year here, and we've had to deal with LGA cuts every single time, whether it came from the governor or the legislature, but it's been sort of part of the fabric of legislating local budgets since I've been here and maybe before.
Madam Chair, can I comment on that?
Sure.
One of the sense that I have is that I think it's a good thing to have a complex issue like that be reflected in these budgets. At the end of the day, if I'm in Minneapolis and if I own a significant building paying 8, 10, 11 bucks a square foot in property taxes, and I can see that there's been a change, my engagement with the policymakers at the council level is going to be much more significant. And I would imagine that the explanation that comes back is, you know, we're doing these things and we've had to adjust for this significant decrease in our LGA. So I think that's a positive element of this program, to take all that data and make it much more streamlined so that the engagement can take place, hopefully.
Thank you.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a town hall meeting just Saturday, and I thought, now, mind you, my cities don't get local government aid, so I have five cities. One gets a little bit, but mainly they've lost all their local government aid, and they've never really had their much in market value homestead credit. And I thought, well, I'm going to have to explain that very complicated program to these people at this town hall meeting. And the 40 people there, they knew market value homestead credit. And they were furious that their property taxes have increased like they have. And they know why they've increased. And it isn't because local government officials aren't coding things right. It's because the market value homestead credit was taken away in the budget agreement last year. They know that. So I was kind of surprised that they're that aware of it. I own a business property, just a small one, but after having served on a local city council for a long period of time, I know how city budgets work. And to some people, they might seem too complicated, but the one thing you have to remember is that half of that budget goes for public safety. You know, we all like our police and fire protection and street sewers and water. We like them to work quite well. It might seem to be more too complicated, but when you talk about something as encompassing as this, and this was brought up at the Municipal Legislative Commission reception a couple of weeks ago, Representative Downey introduced or talked about his bill, and the people in that audience were local officials, and one of the city council members from one of my cities said, well, wait a minute, how are we going to pay for this? So you're presenting an idea that's very expensive, and we're trying very hard to institute some mandate relief against for our local governments rather than adding extra burdens, and I'm one of those that likes to see the mandates lifted somewhat. I don't know. We're seeing so many bills in this committee, because this is the first stop. It's almost like a Hate Minnesota campaign. It's like nothing works in Minnesota anymore. And I'm actually aghast at that, because I think Minnesota works quite well. And I think our cities and counties and school districts, I think they're working quite well. And to try to hit at them with a heavy hammer, I just don't think it's going to work. I don't think it's going to work for the future. We've got to love our state, and we've got to, I can see trying to find efficiencies, but when you come at it with a heavy hammer, I just don't see that this is good for the state or the cities. It just kind of puts everyone on edge. It puts everyone's becoming polarized. I heard it in my town hall meeting. They said, I voted against the market value homestead credit being part of the budget deal. They said, I know you did. What can we do? And I don't know what to tell them. Where can they go? How can they change what's happening to their state and their cities? People are very uncomfortable with what's happening. with this attitude of Minnesota doesn't work anymore. I don't get it.
I think I'd like to have Representative Downey respond to that. My understanding is this has mostly to do with transparency. Can you also, Representative Downey, when you respond, are you on tax committee? Are you
Manager,
on the tax committee?
Yes, I am on the tax.
The market value homestead credit, do you happen to know off the top of your head how many times out of the last 10 years or so has the legislature actually provided the state government with their market value homestead credit relief that they were supposed to get? It seems like it wasn't a lot of times, if I recall.
Madam Chair, I've only been here 3 years, but I think in the 3 years I've been here, the market value homestead credit was never fully funded by the state. My recollection is that it was maybe $89 million last year out of a promise that was, I think, north of $200 million, $260 million perhaps.
Yeah, my belief, and I'm not on taxes, maybe someone could correct me, but I think it's only been maybe one time in the last 10 years or so that it's actually been fully funded. So, two times? Yeah, so.
Madam Chair,
Representative Downey.
Thank you. I would just like to respond to a couple of the points that have been made. And the focus, and I know these are the DFL talking points, is to turn this into a discussion about market value homestead credit and LGA cuts. And LGA was not cut from the previous year. I believe we fully funded it at last year's levels the previous year's levels in the last budget. And I get that. You're trying to make your points. But in many ways, they actually just reinforce the basic purpose of this bill. Is we can go back and forth, and you're just basically repeating the debate and the finger pointing that went on across Minnesota that I think was pretty destructive and was largely unintelligible to voters because they don't have this most basic of information about the spending side of their local governments. And so everything exists in the world of taxes and levies and levy caps and market value cap. I mean, all this stuff, right? And the basic concept of, gee, what did your government spend last year versus what is it spending this year versus what is it planning to spend next year just doesn't exist, at least in a readily understandable form. And so this bill attempts to provide that. And Representative Scalzi, you mentioned that this is a heavy hammer. I hate to disagree, but this is the budget document that comes out from my city, I think arguably a very well-run city, one that I'm proud of. 173 pages, it's got charts, it's got graphs, it's got every program area, you know, baked down to the nth degree. And I tell you what, you read this and it's really difficult to understand. And in my mind, this is the heavy hammer that our citizens have a really hard time understanding. And if you can envision a one or a two-page handout that has a basic table of the maybe 10 or so spending areas year to year with a nice graph to support it, and to think that this is a huge burden on our cities. I mean, honestly, I think my high school daughter could probably sit down at a spreadsheet for a couple of hours and model out the framework that would be required. So this is the heavy hammer, and I think what we're offering is just a nice light touch that's an easy burden to bear by our cities when the value is so high for our citizens to understand what's going on.
Okay, tip of follow-up. We'll move on to the next person on the list is Representative Simon.
Thank you. I think this is for Ms. Is it Rico?
Rocco.
I'm sorry. Sorry. And also maybe for Representative as well. I think generally, you know, transparency is good for its own sake, and I like the underlying motivation of this bill, which is, hey, make things more simple for people, for average everyday people. I like that. But you prefaced your remarks by talking about what your members have said about property taxation of commercial property. So I take it that there are certain findings that you expect here, and I'll just cut to the chase. I mean, I assume this is about, in part, being able to show and demonstrate that cities are not spending money well, or that they're spending too much money, or that they're spending money wastefully. Is that part of your motivation here? Do you hope to identify and isolate instances where you believe cities are, you know, pigs at the trough or being irresponsible with public money? Is that part of this, because you feel that your members are burdened by property taxes?
Madam Chair.
Ms. Rocco.
Representative. We can't make any judgments on whether cities and counties are spending their money wisely or not. We can't make that decision because it's very difficult for us to understand the cost drivers. And so we would hope that this would turn up a number of things, including cities that are doing a great job. But we can't make a judgment as to whether cities are spending their money wisely or not. That's beyond our purview.
I guess, Madam Chair.
Representative Simon, did you want to direct her to a certain point that would lead you to conclude that? Or
no.
Okay, go ahead.
But my follow-up question is, and again, I think the underlying purpose of this, which is transparency, ease of use, ease of understanding for everyday people, is good and right. I guess the question, maybe a philosophical one, is if the ultimate idea is that, and you haven't said this, but if the ultimate idea is that cities or someone receiving state aid directly or indirectly ought to open its books in a more transparent way, do you think this same standard should apply to those in the private sector who also receive state funds directly or indirectly? Should they be made to open their books and standardize spending based on various object codes or other centralized criteria? Do you think that's fair as well?
Mr. Rinke?
Madam Chair and Representative, that's an interesting idea. In many cases, it's already happening when the development agreement is initiated, and if there's tax, TIF money, or those type of things, the full budgets of that project are already part of their public record. It does cause some consternation to the developers as far as the privacy of that data. We all know that this is a very competitive market, and my tenants in my building are going to get robbed to go over to somebody else's. So we already do much of the disclosure, and I don't know if that answers your question.
You know, Representative,
Madam Chair, could I respond to the representative's comment too? From a city council member, I think if we're proposing a new, first we don't take any LGA in our community. We're proposing a new community center. For some reason, the groundswell has worked its way up to the point where we're serious about it. And a dozen business owners come in and start asking questions about the implications of that community service on the budget and what's going to happen with the tax base. What this does is we may still do it, because that's our decision as policy members and leaders of the community. But it's going to engage that community and allow me to explain the reasons for the benefits of that expenditure at a much, much greater level than we can right now. So I would look forward to that.
Okay, Representative Beard.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm going to be a little blunt and direct here. It has to do with a phrase I heard called hate Minnesota government. Now, there's a reporter sitting right behind you guys, and I hope you're listening to where the ratcheting up of the rhetoric came from in this discussion. This is not a hate Minnesota government. When somebody with financial and management expertise, probably one of the smartest guys in the room in that regard, brings forth a bill that talks about accounting, transparency, in a way we can make government more transparent, more accountable to people who actually are paying for it. And I wish we'd keep that in mind. And I'm speaking directly to the reporter. When we have motives that are questioned, when people bring forth out of their life experience hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of training and experience that has made other people who actually work in the entrepreneurial world a lot of money or using their assets more efficiently and more productively, I think this is a good thing. This is Minnesota government at work, Representative Downey. We've got captains of industry or representatives of captains of industry sitting here who are saying, we just want to know how we can even make an informed decision. And yet the chanting points from the other side of the table are that somehow this is hating Minnesota government. And I'm not picking on my friend from Roseville. I know she has the talking points. We've been in the minority. We've gotten the talking points as well. But I just want the press to notice how the rhetoric has escalated here as we're trying to have an intelligent decision by people of goodwill about an issue that we all agree on. To be very clear, I'll speak for all the Republicans in this room. Government is very necessary and very important in an orderly society. How we pay for that government and how we account for it is what's at question here. Not do we love them or do we hate them. That's immaterial to this discussion. We all agree, and let's all agree, let's all admit right now, Government is very important in an orderly society. We're representatives from the voters in our district to come here and talk about how we administer and pay for government, and that we have some difference over the reach of government, but that's what this place is for. And so, Madam Chair, there's no question there. There's just a comment and a plea to the press that they would actually pay attention to the direction of the conversation and what's happening here. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative McFarland, you're next on the list.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to, we all got handouts, and I thought I had asked somebody if we had any samples of your summaries, and they are in the handout. I don't know if everybody knew that. They don't look very hard. They look like something that could be the beginning of one of those big reports that you showed. So just wanted to bring that forward.
Thank you. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think, Representative Beers, some of the response that you see is a bill, first of all, that only has Republican authors on it. And as far as I know, I was never given an opportunity to be an author on the bill. So forgive members of the minority for believing that this is a partisan bill from the beginning. Second of all, last year in this committee, we heard all about mandate relief and how mandates for state government were the things that were driving costs for local governments. So forgive us again for being confused about what's worse, state government mandates or local governments not reporting financial information in sufficient detail. So to the goal of actually understanding what this bill would do, Madam Chair, I wonder if I could ask Ms. Rocco a question?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Ms. Rocco.
I take it that your slide number 6, which is on page 3 of your handout, is the desired summary of information that you'd like to see?
Ms. Rocco?
Madam Chair, Representative, the answer is yes.
Representative Winkler.
Thanks. And Madam Chair, I'll be asking, I'm sure local governments will be up here as well. As I compare slide 6 to slide 5, the primary difference is that we get a breakdown of employee costs by salaries, pension, FICA, health care, other benefits, and then we get a breakout of supplies and purchase services. And then the other things down the list are mostly the same between 5 and 6. Slide 5 represents an insufficient presentation of data. Slide 6 presents the goal, and the primary difference is breaking out supplies, purchase services, and specific employee costs. Is that a summary of the difference?
Madam Chair, Representative, generally I would say yes. I mean, generally.
Representative Winkler?
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, Mr. Ranke has a comment.
Mr. Ranke.
Madam Chair and member, the significant difference that you see there is that the slide 6 is the employee costs across all the program areas that are reflected in slide 5. And that's a significantly helpful, different way of just presenting information. I think maybe underlying your point is that this data, again, is already there. And so the summarizing of it within the financial management systems into salaries across the board, again, is my contention that there's some effort, but it's surely not significant because, again, that data is already there.
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, I agree. I mean, it seems to me we should be able to compare data across departments and aggregate it, and I'd be surprised if it wasn't already in the accounting system in a way that you could do that, although I'm reminded that I think 4 years ago I tried to find out how much the state government spends on homeland security or anti-terrorism type initiatives, and there was no possible way for the state to answer that question. So it's well and good for us to point to local governments and their need to provide this data, but there is a great deal of work we should do at the state to be able to do the same thing, and we've made some strides, but I think we do have to be careful about complaining about other units of government when the legislature itself quite often makes it impossible for the state to provide the same quality of data. But It seems to me that that data should be available. And what I compare the kind of the outcome here, this seems pretty simple. This looks like a different way of providing an executive summary of the thick report that Representative Downey shared. And at the same time, I see that the Municipal Legislative Commission, Mayor Hovland, his letter to the chair talked about the timing of reporting and the availability of annual budgets and audited financial statements. And it just seems to me that there could be a less prescriptive way of getting the same information if we were willing to work with local government units to find. I mean, this what you're showing here in slide six is really pretty straightforward. It seems like your bill might be putting a whole lot tougher requirement on them, and I'd be curious to get their thoughts. But the question for Representative Downey is, are you willing to work on your bill in order to find common ground with local government units to provide this kind of cross department data that you're looking for?
Representative Downey.
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, short answer is yes, of course. The only, I'll say, substantive critique of the bill is that they think there's a timing issue with the date. The value of the dates that are in the bill at present, in my mind, are that for the first time voters would actually have this information before their fall elections as compared to after, where interest would be heightened and perhaps a little extra degree of accountability for those facing election in November might help. So I like the dates as they are. I appreciate that the certified tax levy that's required in the September timeframe is different from a complete budget, and so meeting their obligation under the bill to produce the look-forward budgetary column of the report might be difficult in September, but certainly all of the other numbers would be pretty easy. So short answer, yes, I'm glad to work with them on that date issue. The rest of it, I mean, I'm glad to hear the testimony from city folks here. I agree, Representative Winkler, this is not that difficult. In fact, if anything, we are dramatically simplifying what is an incredibly complicated mandate right now in terms of what local governments are obligated to report. And frankly, I cannot imagine that this is an additional mandate. I think what we're doing is shrinking this to something that is far more intelligible. And I'd have a hard time any local government coming in here and substantiating that they can't somehow take two pages out of the 100 or 300 page document that they've got right now and turning them into something that taxpayers can understand. I struggle to see how that's some huge burdensome mandate when, again, if you look at these documents, largely the information's included in the tables and oftentimes in program area appendices and the like. This is just bringing something up that's very intelligible for average citizens to understand.
Representative Winkler.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Downey, I think we're now getting into the rhetorical side of things again. If it's so difficult, if it's, and you're essentially saying they can just take their complicated report and create a one-page summary of it. And if I compare slides 5 and 6 from NIAP, I don't know that slide 5 is more complex for the average citizen to comprehend than slide 6. I just think it's a different way of looking at the data. So I don't think the point here is that finances are complicated and citizens are uninformed. I think the issue is that you want to be able to compare data and get a breakdown at a more detailed level and compare it in different sorts of ways. And I, for one, think it would be better to ask the local government units why that would be difficult instead of presuming that it's no problem, because I think we're kind of talking around different things. So my question to them is, can we break it down by these topic areas and compare across departments? And is there a less intrusive way than this bill in order to do that? I think that's a legitimate question. And I hope we're going to be actually listening to their answers instead of just saying that, you know, we heard from NIAP and Reform 2.0 and we're moving forward as is. I hope they're actually going to engage in that discussion.
And I think we do have some other people that are probably going to want to testify. We do have several member questions. Maybe we'll take a few more questions, the ones that we have on the list, before we open it up for additional testimony, if that's all right with everybody. The names I have on the list, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess some of the stuff that I was going to point out about the unfunded mandate, that this looks to be another unfunded mandate that we're putting on, and we've been discussing the last few years about taking mandates off of local governments. I know when I chaired the local government committee, that was one of the big things that we tried to work on there, and taking those things off while we still maintain transparency for our local governments, or well, their budgets. But this discussion was going on here about the rhetoric that going on, the rise of the rhetoric. I mean, it started out in the beginning, the description of the bill, when Representative Downing talked about in his remarks that he put this bill forward in his frustration over all the finger pointing that went on in the off session. And I guess I take a little bit of umbrage at the fact that we're being accused of having talking points over here, because if we do, no one gave them to me. So I guess that's maybe your caucus does that, hands them out. We haven't been handed out in our committee or our caucus the talking points on this. It's just, you know, if we're looking at trying to figure out how government spends their money and how local governments spend their money, I think that's a good goal. And having it simplified or simple that people can understand, but one person's simple is another person's not enough information. So, I mean, we've got to make sure when we're talking about this, you hold up a thick report. That could be all the stuff that they've been required to report. I mean, I got a list here from the League of Cities of all the things that they're required to report on, and that might be in that long report. If you're talking about adding a simpler way of doing it, or a pie chart so people can look at it, I guess that's not a bad idea. But what I'm looking at here, again, in slide 5 and 6 here, is that it's just a different way of doing it, and it's that this is the way we want it done, but you're doing it this way, and so it's wrong. I think that's also a very simple way of looking at it. It's, you know, we can look at these things in a lot of different ways, but I guess the rhetoric that's going on here, and it seems like it's very hot here about this, is this side accusing that side of using it for political balance, and the other side accusing us of using it for political, you know, for political points. You know, I don't see this bill as helping anything. In fact, I think, like I said, I think it's just another unfunded mandate that we're throwing on local governments. Is this is another way you've got to spend money, and it's going to cost you money, and we're not, you know, you got to change your accounting system. So it's the way I want it. And I guess this is just, I don't see this as being helpful in the discussion or helpful in getting transparency out there for local governments or for the average citizen.
Okay. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just going on with that a little bit more, I just think we have to be careful about some of the words that we use, and, you know, on both sides. I don't hate government. I don't think that Representative Downey's intent is spurred by a hate of government. It's simply, and we don't mean to imply, I don't think that government doesn't work, just that there are some things that isn't working maybe the way that it should, or that can't work better. I believe that the intent is to do things to help government to work better into the future. The question is, how can we do things better? There is an increased demand, I think, for the public for transparency in the expenditure of public money, and I think that that is legitimate. And if there are ways that we can get that done, I would hope we can do it in a bipartisan manner. And I will just say that I invite all Democrats to sign on to any Erdahl bill anytime they want.
Thank you. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This has been an interesting topic. Reviewing the letters that we've got, and, you know, the town hall meetings I attended, as many of you did, a few things pop up. One is, as Representative Winkler touched upon, the timeliness of the reports. But, you know, you really need to have that information for the city council members before they vote on a budget. And if you already have that information, it's, you know, running a query or a, you know, app or a script. So I wasn't concerned about the timing in this bill. And then Representative Nelson touched upon required reports. You know, I'm familiar with GAP or AAP and some of the other things that come, a lot of them federal, some from the state. So there's a great deal of data out there. And the biggest problem is not, you know, having the data, it's taking that data, whether you're a city or a business or a person, and converting it into a format that people can understand or easily comprehend. And having that executive summary, as some people have said, this kind of thing makes it a lot easier, because most of the people, when I was on the school board and a treasurer, or when I've attended city council meetings, their questions come from confusion. And the confusion is what propagates some of the frustration and you know, the heightened emotion in these discussions. And so by taking that data, and somebody could maybe let the committee know if it's general practice to already use object codes, and if they're not, I think it ought to be, because it's very useful. But that's what I see this bill is taking that complex set of data points for the city, converting it to something that the average person can understand. And then lastly, the cost. Frankly, if we can better communicate with people, we will take care of those confused calls and queries. And if we have the information readily available, we won't have to have those interrupts when somebody says, hey, what are you doing? So I think in the long run, other than initially creating the query, I see this as being a savings to the cities in both time and effort. Thank you.
Thanks. I think we have one more question, and then I would like to leave it open for witnesses. Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I had a couple kind of comments and questions, and they add up to one point. And the first is just a list of logistical questions, which is there somebody here to talk about this who's from a bigger city? You know, I'm thinking particularly of Rochester, Duluth, Minneapolis, St. Paul. Also, who will pay for this to take place? You know, clearly this is going to probably change current needs and require new elbow work. I also kind of want to make the comment and echo what Representative Winkler said, which is that slides 5 and 6 each offer kind of pluses and minuses over how the information is conveyed. And it reminds me of my work in the private sector. When we have new leadership at the company, we want to convey the information in new ways because that's what suits the current leadership. And it's not necessarily a bad thing. It's not necessarily a good thing. It's just the needs of the current leadership. And I guess ultimately all of that brings me to the question, what's the best way to serve Minnesotans? And I wondered if this bill had gone through Representative Carol McFarland's redesign committee, and if there had been discussion there for what is really the best way to go forward, what's the best information to convey, and then let's step aside and design what it is we want to do to serve Minnesotans.
Do we want to comment on that? And I think we do have a few people that probably will answer some of your questions. So why don't, at this time, if it's all right with everyone, we'll allow people, the folks to testify from cities, maybe some of the folks that sent us letters. Ms. O'Rourke, would you like to go first?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee and Madam Chair, my name is Jennifer O'Rourke with the League of Minnesota Cities. We are the statewide association and wanted to be on record with this bill today. I think you guys have made so many good points in terms of dialogue that's important to have on this bill on both sides, from both sides of the table. Cities do not have a problem with transparency, and we know that this is a goal of this bill. I want to actually thank NIOP and the Minnesota Taxpayers Association. We did invite them to come in this summer to our fiscal futures policy group. They did that. We anticipated this bill coming forward this session after last spring and conversations we had, and, you know, just where the direction's been going on these issues. You're going to hear from a city administrator and a finance director in a few minutes, hopefully, just about the complexities in city budgets and what they deal with at the local level and trying to find that sweet spot in getting that kind of information to the public in a digestible manner. One thing I'd really like to point out, and we passed it out earlier, is the letter that comes from the city of Crystal, and specifically their finance director. You know, over the last couple of weeks that this bill has been out there in draft form, that NIOP was good enough to share with us, and we have met a few times since last summer, and one since session started. You know, when you have 853 cities and 87 counties, there's a whole lot of service delivery and shared services that's going on. You know this because it's really been an emphasis the last couple of years at the legislature, both when Democrats were in the majority in the legislature and, you know, as things have flipped. And this letter, I think, does a dynamite job of illustrating the complexities in city budgets, especially when they're sharing services. This letter gets at a shared fire department between two metro cities, Crystal and New Hope. And their finance director was really struggling with how to compare themselves to like cities, and I think you can read for yourself. There are six or eight factors here dealing with personnel, the actual delivery of medical services, what they do with equipment, and actual fire halls, that you just can't compare City A to City B. And there are changes over the years in how services are delivered. Certain shared services agreements don't necessarily last forever, and there have been media reports and pretty good stories over the last year, I think, to some of that effect. The one other thing I wanted to just highlight for you, we did beef up our policy, if you will, and I believe Representative Nelson highlighted that. We added, I think, 17 budgets and reports that were required to report to the state auditor. I left my chunk of paper back there, but there's a stack about that high, and that's just five of the reports that cities are required to submit annually to the state auditor. So I would just point that out for you. The one thing I'd kind of like to close with, if you will, as far as the unfunded mandate piece of this goes, you know, it's been interesting working on this issue over the last 5 or 10 years, is the unfunded mandate issue has really morphed into redesign and reform. And you know, to be honest with you, some of the mandate relief efforts have not gone real far. House File 705 from last year, frankly, was stripped down so that every piece of city mandate relief that was in there was taken out, and it was pretty much a county bill at that point, and it was still not something that legislators in the governor's office could stomach at the end of the day. And frankly, House File 705 were not heavy lifting kind of mandates. So I'm going to close my remarks with that. I believe the finance directors that are here can speak more specifically to some of the direct questions that you had, and let you know that respectfully, we do want to be on record with our concerns of the unfunded mandates part of this bill, and need to be on record today opposing the bill in its current form. We will be around, obviously, to work with Representative Downey and others if there are ways to change this as it moves forward.
Representative Erdahl, do you have a question for Ms. O'Rourke?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Madam Chairman. Ms. O'Rourke, how much do you think it's going to cost? Do you have any idea?
Ms. O'Rourke.
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, thank you for that question. I don't know. I did put in a request, or we put in a request, if you will, as this bill moves forward for a local impact note. I think the city staff who are here can maybe speak to some of that. I know I've heard from cities, Stillwater, for example, as they saw that this was introduced, they've gone from six people in their finance department to three. And some cities are kind of pushing information out in this direction already. But like I said before, it's very hard to compare apples to oranges, if you will. And if I could close with, a lot of the conversations have been around cities. I just want to remind you that counties are part of this bill, too.
Thank you. And I suspect some of that information will come in a future committee, since they don't have that information available now. Did you want to speak, Mr. Carlson?
Please, if I could, Madam Chair. I'm Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association, whose membership includes 13 of the larger counties in the state. And I'll speak to a couple of the premises, one which will answer Representative Erdahl's first before I go through my handout. First, I think, you know, some of the concerns here have been driven by supposed concerns that local government spending is out of control. The data in terms of our taxes shows exactly the opposite. The last 3 years, the property taxes have gone up 3.2%, 1.9%, and the levy, the thing that local governments are responsible for, along with the state's commercial industrial property tax, has gone up 1.2%. For the prior seven-year period, the lowest increase was 5.6%. So we've cut back substantially. in terms of the cost of this bill and discussions that I had with Representative Downey, he pointed out that a county that happened to be one of my members has already put this information up on its website. I pointed out to the representative that, in fact, the information that they put out on the website, and I can show the committee that information if they like, does not meet the minimum requirements of this bill. In two examples alone, it did not include 4 years' worth of history, nor did it break out the employee compensation by FICA taxes, by pensions, by health care, and other benefits. They have spent 120 man hours so far putting up that information. And this is a large entity that has a relatively large finance department. They anticipate that they're going to invest at least another 100 to possibly 200 man hours in getting up this information. And it certainly is probably going to go beyond what is required here. But this gives you an example of the sort of investments that's required to meet this obligation. So if I could turn to my presentation, our four areas of concern have already been mentioned. Is first the timing issue. Secondly, that implementation will be challenging, particularly for smaller cities and counties. Third, as has been mentioned by Ms. O'Rourke, the cities, counties already provide extensive information at substantial cost, and we frankly pose the question, how much additional reporting do we have to do, at what expense, and what does this do to enhance citizen involvement? And finally, if the focus is on compensation, as it seems to be, that information is already available as public data. All you have to do is ask your individual county, city, and it can already be aggregated and compared from ready available sources. In fact, the Minnesota Taxpayers Association is one of the proponents of this bill, has done just that. In a relatively recent report they've done on employee compensation. With regards to the timing, as is already stated, this comes 15 days after we certify our preliminary levies. At that point, we basically have determined what our total maximum budget will be for the coming year and what the revenue is. We don't have the detail. And it's at a very, very high workload portion of the year, particularly for those cities where the city clerk is also the budget person, she's also running elections, and the same for the counties where the county auditor is also the budget person, responsible for running elections that are occurring during that time, and also responsible for preparing the actual truth and taxation notices. Besides timing, as I've said, the object code basis of reporting with 4 years of history will require additional staff time to both generate the data in the manner required, and this bill doesn't just do it in the simplified category. It's in a category, the manner that ultimately will be dictated by the state auditor that will be potentially more complicated, and also put that information up on the website or to publish it. Ease of compliance is going to be dictated by how closely the city or county's chart of accounts. The basic framework of their accounting budget system aligns with this new reporting manner. If the two don't align, then basically the county or city is going to have to run two books to report this information. As I've said, there's already extensive information put up on budgets in a consistent format at the state auditors that I'll get into a little bit more detail. But even Hennepin County, the largest local government in the state, has difficulty aligning its information, what is required by the state auditor, on a programmatic basis right now. As I said, this is going to be considerable expense, above and beyond what we do right now. For just the truth and taxation notice, which I think in most instances is what taxpayers want, just simply, what does this mean to me? How much is it going to cost me? It cost local governments in 2007 over $3 million to publish those notices, respond to information requests, and hold the hearings that they're required to hold to do as part of that. In addition, as I've said, summary budget data is required to be reported to the state auditor every year. It's compiled and posted as reports for all cities and all counties on the office's website. Similarly, our audited financial reports, our actual expenditures, our actual revenues is also reported, and again, it's compiled and posted. finally, the state auditor's website already has a convenient tool on it that allows you to compare between counties, say what's the per capita expenditures in a particular category, and what's your respective local government's rank to its peers. In addition to that requirement, finally, cities and counties are also required to publish their summary budget documents, either in a newsletter if you're a city, or in a newspaper if you don't have a newsletter at the city level, and all counties must publish. And that's additional expense. St. Louis County, for example, costs $500 a year. Finally, we have to do the same with our audited financial statements if you're a county, or for all cities over 2,500. The cost for that publication can literally run to $1,000 annually. Finally, as I mentioned, this focuses compensation. The information is already available. I frankly question how useful the data is in the aggregated manner that's possible. I think the real thing that you're interested in is how much do we pay for a clerk? How much do we pay for a janitor? This information doesn't provide that. And furthermore, comparisons between entities is difficult because entities vary. For example, Carver County, all policing is provided by the county sheriff's office. It's not provided by any of the cities, and consequently, the staffing and compensation would be relatively large in that county, but relatively low in all those cities except Chaska, which does have its own police department. Finally, if your concern is that somehow local government employees are overcompensated, then let's focus on the issues that drive that compensation. He basically got us waving in the wind, on one hand telling us to cut compensation, on the other hand, laws like pay equity, several provisions of the state's law that apply only to local governments that give unions unusual authority over benefits, drive that compensation up. If that's your concern, then let's focus on those laws. With that, I'll conclude.
Thank you. And if you could keep your, since we had such a long presentation that I was unaware of, if we could keep the comments relatively short, and if you could identify yourself for the tape.
Sure. My name is Susan Iverson, and I am the finance director for the city of Arden Hills. I am also a budget reviewer for the National GFOA. I do train and speak in Minnesota on budgeting, how to do budgets, how to do fund accounting, and I teach the clerks, and I teach government accounting people. GFOA's budget is what many. This affects 225 cities out of the 850 in Minnesota. Most of them use the GFOA program, and that program is a document that is supposed to be written in an easily understood format that any person and the average person on the street can read. It is not just for financials, it's also a communication document. It's for financial, it's for policy, and it's for organization. So that entire document in its entirety is telling you what the strategic plans are for the city, what challenges they're facing. It goes through their organizational structure, and it does the finances, and it does put summary data and charts and tables in there. When I looked at legislation, when they talk about the electronic budget, many times we don't have all of the work. We don't have it all worked out with the cuts when they were talking about the timing. Many times we don't get the numbers from the state until mid-August. We have to have our budgets levied by mid-September, so we maybe can have a work session with the council at the end of August, and then we have to certify our levies at our first September meeting. That doesn't give us a lot of time to figure out what we're going to cut and where our programs are going to be at. Some cities are not apples to apples either, because if you take Arden Hills and you take Roseville, you're not going to get the same data, because we contract our engineering, we contract our fire, our police services, we contract our IT services. So if you want to look at object codes, you're not going to find any costs in my salaries, personal services, or any of that for fire or police protection, because it's all going to be under other services and charges. Where if you look at Roseville, you're going to see a lot of salaries, benefits, personal services, materials, and supplies in there. So if somebody's going to look at this data when it's published, you're not going to have an apples-to-apples comparison. The other thing is we, almost all of us, use the State Auditor's Chart of Accounts or something like it, and we do have object code data. Although it's a lot of data, there's a lot of different kinds of funds. And in our budgets, when we break them down, we break down personal services, materials and supplies, other charges and services, capital, debt. But I don't understand what it's going to do to further break employee costs down. We don't have people in our cities. And I have worked in cities the size of 450, 3,100, and 10,000. We don't have people who are just primarily in one department or doing one function. My salary is cut across general fund, special revenue funds, and enterprise funds. And same with public works. So you're going to get distorted numbers if you're actually trying to come up with costs and just looking at one area. As far as publication, some of the cities, like when I was in Northern America, we may use GovOffice because it was affordable for us to even get a website because we couldn't afford the cost to get a website. But even when you have GovOffice, the amount of information, and even at the city of Arden Hills that we are using, the amount of information that we can put on there, if we want to put a big document like this, we have to pay for more storage and more space on there. And I don't know that some of these smaller cities can afford the cost of adding that to their websites. And if they don't have it on their website and they have to publish it, you've already heard what the costs are just to publish summary budgets and publish our financials. So this will be a huge cost. I guess that. And we do, at our truth and taxation hearings, we do get into all of the details. We do get into the line item changes and exactly why. And we do have citizens that come. They watch us on TV. And many times I do have emails at my desk by the time I'm done with the presentation. We have had citizens who have come and stood up and told the council that we have put it in an easily format for them that they could understand, and it was not at a technical level.
Thank you. Are you Mr. Larson?
Yes.
Welcome to the committee, and if you could just identify yourself for the tape.
Certainly. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mark Larson. I am the city administrator for the city of Glencoe. We're about 45 miles west of the Twin Cities, population about 5,800 people. We are a full-service community. We have a general fund right now of about $3.2 million. About 7 years ago, it was about $3.7 million. Over the course of the last many years, we have had to cut our budgets considerably. We have lost staff. We're down from 31 full-time equivalents to 27 full-time equivalents. Our police department's down from 11 to 8 full-time officers. Nearly a third of the employees are paid staff through nonprofit or non-tax dollars, such as enterprise funds, water, wastewater treatment, and liquor store. I only have two people in my finance department. I, as a city administrator, wear many, many hats. I am not the finance person. I'm not the finance person for the city, but it is my responsibility to prepare the budget. In the preparation of the budget, we do try to simplify it for not only the citizens, but for the city council. The city council are not experts in governmental accounting, and typically I do try to simplify it and do some things very similar to what is being requested, but not in the exact same format. Representative Downey has kind of stereotyped or lumped all of local governments as being not able to be understood by the common citizen. And as I look at 5 and 6 of the two different reports that are presented here, you know, I try to find what is more simple to understand from the common citizen standpoint, and I'm not sure what it is. You know, each city does things differently, as Sue has indicated. You know, even line items such as debt service, if you decide to do a project, you're going to have higher debt service in the future. It, you know, even things like health care benefits, it does show a cost for health care benefits, but it doesn't break out what the employee part of that is. So if health care goes up, we've seen our staff not only cut in staff, but we have froze wages over the last 3 years. The city or the employees pick up more and more of their health care benefits. If you have an unhealthy group, that is not a positive thing for you when you go out in the health care field to solicit health care information. You know, there's an assumption that people want the information in prescribed format. I'm not sure that that is correct. We have 2 to 3 people show up at our truth and taxation hearings every year. there are very few people that come in and ask for the information. And when they do ask, we do walk through it, and it's presented to them in a format that is simple and they understand. I guess I'm here for questions at this point.
Representative Simon.
Thank you. To either Ms. Iverson or Mr. Larson, there was some testimony earlier by Mr. Carlson, and though he's from the counties and not from the city, that the information on aggregate employee costs, whether it's salaries and wages, pension, health care, et cetera, that is already available, that someone could do a data practices request. Is that your understanding? Do people ask for that from you? Is that how you operate? I'm trying to get at this issue of the employee cost, which seems to be a lot of what's being discussed here today. Is that readily available in your experience?
Yes.
Or not?
Simerson?
Yes, it would be readily available. Somebody requested it from me.
Okay.
Representative Simon.
I'm just trying to, so one objection to the bill might be that it's asking for too much information. Another might be that it's asking for not the right kind of information. And Mr. Larson, you raise an issue, an interesting issue about the employee share. It could be that someone could look at a chart like slide 6 on page 3 of the handout and see healthcare costs going up, but what it might not show is that the employee share is also going up, and maybe their percentage is going up even more quickly. So I just want to understand whether you don't speak for one another, I understand, but are you saying that the bill wouldn't tell the full story, or that the information is hard to produce, or that it's not hard to produce, but that it's not a proper comparison? I'm just trying to understand.
It's not a proper comparison. It's not going to tell the whole story. The one example, the letter you got from Crystal, some of the ones I was using, the comparison between us and Roseville, that is majorly what I'm concerned about, is that it's not going to tell the full story. Each city operates different, and there's different reasons for it.
Representative Simon.
Well, just so I understand, so you both agree that if someone, whether it's NIOP or the Taxpayers Association or Mr. and Mrs. Arden Hills, wanted to find out in the aggregate the amount for salaries and wages over the last 4 years, you could do that. You could produce that.
Yes, and I actually, if you look on slides 5 and 6, I actually do provide the data both ways, but I don't break down employee costs. I have total personal services. I don't break down each salary, pension, FICA, whatever, and we do have that information.
So,
Representative Simon.
One more, and thanks for your indulgence, Madam Chair. So, if this bill were to go forward, and I understand that you oppose it in its current form, but if it were, are you saying that you would also like to see other information reported, such as whether there's contracting for services, such as whether there are joint services between and among other municipalities, such as the employee share of these various areas? I don't want to put words in your mouth. I understood you to be at least suggesting that, but maybe you weren't.
Mr. Larson?
I don't think that that's quite correct. It's just that there are different ways to look at it, and in a lot of the information, what's it going to be used for? It's not that it can't be broken out or presented differently, but to compare it with, I don't know what you're going to compare it with. You know, if you're comparing city to city, I don't know that you're going to get an apples and apples comparison.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I want to refer to just a kudos where kudos are due. The letter from Crystal refers to the fact that Crystal and New Hope actually combined their fire department to better serve their cities. This is the kind of work that I think we can all applaud bipartisanly. By the way, while they were doing that, I'm sure they must have had some data somewhere, but they could see that by combining them, they could get better service for their citizens for less money expended, more bang for the buck, as it were. So that's helpful, and that's, I think, instructive of how good accounting and good information can help us make better decisions when we're trying to actually make government work in areas where we agree government has a core function and an essential service that they should provide. I think that's just a comment that's instructional to all of us. As I'm sitting here listening to good committee work, however, this morning, one thing that seems to, I hear, again and again, is that the state auditor requires a lot of this information already. Am I understanding that correctly? Because if I am, then I have a suggestion I might make, Madam Chair. Either the...
Ms. Iverson?
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. The state auditor does require a lot of this, and we do report it more on a program level than the actual optical level, because it's more comparable between cities for the simple fact of what you just said. Arden Hills has done a lot of work at combining together. We have three fire departments into one. We've gone with the county contracting model for police services, those types of things. So when you look from city to city and you compare public safety costs, they're comparable apples to apples, but we're not going to be comparable if you take object code to object code.
Madam Chair, that's exactly my point. I'm glad you answered the question that way, because this is probably a suggestion to Representative Downey, as he's not exactly in the hot seat at the moment. But as we're going forward, I think I understand what he's trying to do here, but it sounds like whenever we set this requirement up for the state auditor to... for all the cities and counties to report things this way, that there must have been a previous legislature somewhere that actually wrestled with this very thing again and trying to help the citizens understand how it works and embodied the whole thing in auditor reports, or reports to the state auditor. My suggestion, Representative Downey, is, and this gets back to something Representative Nelson talked about, we talked about mandates. I'm going to tell you, this is striking me as an additional mandate, so in the interest of no net gain of mandates, first of all, somewhat tongue-in-cheek, Representative Downey, if you could find one to relieve while we're imposing this one, we would be neutral on the mandate front. That would be a good thing, in my opinion. However, it sounds like there is work that's already being done in the reporting at the state auditor's reports. Is there a way we can modify that existing requirement or make that more responsive that accomplishes what the bill is trying to do? You folks don't have to answer that. That's really more for the bill author, unless you care to comment, because I'm thinking that there might be a way to get at this, that we're already collecting the data rather than have you do it again and slice and dice it a little differently. Perhaps we can align the categories or the mission that Representative Downey's on with this bill. My thoughts.
Okay. Representative Winkler had a question. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and actually I kind of conclude where Representative Beard left off. Seems to me that the testimony from the local government units is that it's a mandate and there's a cost, although that there's no number yet. Cost comparisons are misleading, or can be misleading, so we're not going to have an easy comparison just by doing this. And I think there's a concern that we are particularly targeting employee costs when there might be a whole host of other things that are driving rising costs for cities. I guess the question to the local governments is, do you see a way forward to actually work with the bill author to do what Representative Beard suggested, which is to, in some way, change the financial reporting that gets to a way of comparing budgets across your departments in a better way? Or is this just there's nothing that could be done and that you don't want to change anything, or any mandate is a bad, new mandate is a bad thing? Or is there room to kind of work together on this? Because I look at slide 6, and it just seems to me that you must have, if you have the data on employee costs that you could provide for a data practices request, you could just as easily produce it yourself and put it on a website.
It is, it currently is on the Arden Hills web. I mean, we do have it. We do it even at a program level. We do put personal services, you know, we list all those out. We just don't list it by salaries, pension, FICA, healthcare, other benefits.
Madam Chair, Ms. Iverson, I guess the question is, you know, as Representative Beard suggested, is there a way to change financial reporting that may address some of the issues raised in this bill that you could support? And would you be willing to actually work on this, or are we destined for this issue to be a bill that gets rammed through on a partisan basis and may get vetoed and we've accomplished nothing?
I think we'd be willing to work on it. Oh, sorry. I think we'd be willing to work on it, but our concern is just how is the information going to be used and that the right information is put together and reported.
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Ms. Iverson, I think it's legitimate for you to be concerned about how the information can be used against you, but remember, it can all be used against you now anyway. So as long as everybody's working together, you may end up with a better product than if, you know, this is just a kind of political battle between Reform 2.0 and local governments.
Okay, thank you. I think we have someone else who would like to testify, Cindy Geis. welcome to the committee, and if you could just identify yourself for the tape.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the board, committee. My name is Cindy Geis. I'm the Scott County Auditor Director, Mr. Beard, and I am also the Director of the Property and Customer Services Division for Scott County. And I was in conversation with some of my leadership team in Scott County. We have gone through some major reorganizations. We have gone through some major software application changes as we have looked to ways to deliver our services more effectively and more efficiently for our constituency. And with that, it comes difficulty for us in being able to represent data in the same fashion. And I'm going to give you a couple of examples so that you understand the context of what I'm trying to tell you. When, from year to year, we generally deliver items by program because our customers, our taxpayers, our owners of our property within Scott County want to know, where does my money go and what am I going to get for it? And when I look at some of the graphs that were listed on graph number 6, it doesn't tell my property owners or my taxpayers what are the programs that I'm delivering and what is it going to cost them and how can they come to me and better influence where we place our money. So that is the reason why we present our budgets in more of a program area. However, we generally identify those programs at a little bit different cost breakdown. So we don't just lump it together saying our parks and recreation costs X, Y, Z. We will list out, this is what the staffing costs for this program delivery, and these are some of the other program opportunities that we have as we go forward. But in nowhere in here does it say what are some of our high initiatives from a county level. What are we going to deliver this year compared to last year, compared to next year? So because we have different object coding, different funds that we create based upon those, it gets very confusing for our taxpayers. They want to know, take all the object coding out of it, take all of the rhetoric out of it, and show us in a format that's a little bit easier understood. So with that, when we do our presentations to our constituency, we always do it in a fashion that's very understandable by them. We had over 25 people that attended our truth and taxation. 95% of them generally leave after we find out that it's not a valuation question or that they have a valuation question. But this year was the first time that they stayed. They wanted to know more about the budget. And we do have a 300 to 400 page budget that we create for us internally. But never do we, unless they ask for it, do we give that to our taxpayers, because we understand that they definitely would not understand it. So we listen to our taxpayers. We go to outreach, different outreach programs, different outreach areas. We hold citizen surveys, and we ask them, what do you want of us, and how do you want us to display it for you? That gives us ownership to our taxpayers of what is it they're looking for, and we provide that information to them in the manner that they're expecting. The onus is on us. The software is ours. We have to provide the information to them in a manner that they requested. Nowhere in here do I hear that we have gone to the citizens of the counties, our taxpayers. We've heard from business owners, but we haven't heard from the normal Joe Blow that sits on the street and says, I don't get it. My value went down and my taxes went up and I just don't get it. And they come in with frustration. And when we start going through some nuances of different line items, and if they were to see this graph on number 6, that would tell them nothing. Because it doesn't tell them what they're getting for their dollar. What do I personally get? What program am I getting delivered? So we want, in Scott County, we have a new motto, and it's called Delivering What Matters. What is it that our taxpayers and our business owners and the people who reside within our county, what do they want? And we as elected officials, I'm appointed, but our commissioners, our elected officials, it's their responsible to hold us accountable to make sure that we're presenting the information to our constituency in a fashion that is very informative, that it's easily understandable, and that we have any backup data if they want some additional supporting data. So we have gone through a lot of transition in Scott County. We eliminated an entire division. From an accounting object code perspective, it would be very misleading for our taxpayers and for our residents of our county to understand what happened to community development. They totally went away. Well, we shuffled them to human services, we shuffled them to public works, we shuffled them to customer services. We shuffled them all over the place. And our costs have gone up because of it, and theirs went away. Or we eliminated managers and division directors and supervisors and some of the frontline staff because we work in a chaotic manner. I have elections people working in customer service. I have appraisers working in elections. I have land records people working in both areas because we are going to go with whatever priority and whatever fire it is that we need to put out and whatever mandate that we need to meet and deadline that we need to meet. And so we move our staff around all the time. So with that, our object coding from year to year is never very easy for our county because we constantly remove departments. We change our divisions, and we do things so that we're delivering our services more effectively. In addition, we went through different software applications, so nothing is apples to apples there either. So not only are we moving things internally, but we're also changing our applications. And to get the information, maybe for prior years, in a fashion that's that meets the mandate that this bill is requiring, is probably going to cost us thousands and thousands of man hours because it was so different 4 years ago than what it is today. And how do we tell our constituency that this is what it is on a go-forward basis? I also just want to reiterate one other point that a couple of the cities have brought up and Keith Carlson, and that is that by September 15th, all we are doing is we are approving a picture frame. The picture frame sets the scope as to what it is that we can expend. And how we're going to fund it is totally still to be determined. In addition, if there are other things that come up over the last fourth quarter that requires us to move our monies around again, we don't want to have an approved budget to say this is what we're going to deliver because this is what we feel is necessary. There's still 4 to 5 months of the year left to go. So we just adopt the picture frame at that time, but the pieces of the puzzles that go within that picture frame are far from having any type of accountability to them. For us to be able to publish them on a website where taxpayers are then going to be able to point to it and say, but see, this is what you're spending on this function, because we don't know what we're going to spend yet. We also may be moving revenues around. Do we increase fees? Do we remove fees? We haven't adopted those yet either. So there's a lot of work that we're still doing in that fourth quarter. So with that, I want to say that we are absolutely in support of truth in budgeting and getting information out to our taxpayers, to our residents, to our business owners and our business partners. But I don't think that there was a really good communication with the residents of the state of Minnesota and each of the individual counties and or cities to see what is it are your priorities, your objectives, and your strategic initiatives that you're trying to accomplish over the courses of the next year or maybe 5 years, because we have a 5-year budget in our county.
If you could start to wrap it up, that'd be very helpful.
Okay, and we just want the members here to be considerate of where we're going to go, what we plan on doing, and how we get our information out, because it seems to work. It seems to work for our county and to place a mandate on everybody, because maybe some areas it doesn't work seems to be an inefficient use of our time and of our resources that we currently have, which are at best small. So thank you for your time. And again, we do agree with truth in budgeting. Just let us figure out how we get it there.
Thank you. I think Representative Downey will get you back at the table here, and maybe you could wrap up and we could take some final questions before we come to a vote, if we have any. Any parting thoughts, Representative Downey?
Well, Madam Chair, there's probably a couple dozen comments that I could make in response to the testimony, but you know, a million reasons why you can't do it, and I think all of them evidencing the fact that this is exactly why local government and state government are so unintelligible to rank and file voters out there. And so we got a choice. We can do this and let everybody see what we're doing and make it understandable, or we can continue to do this. And I'm hard-pressed to understand how this, when most of the data is already out there, that they're working it and massaging it, why we can't do this. And it seems to me that It has way less to do with actually being able to do it and way more being uncomfortable that they'll be compared to somebody else. And I want to make sure people realize there is nothing in the bill about comparing one community to another. This is all about, in an existing community, comparing previous years to what you're doing this year and the future year so people can see the trends and understand exactly what's driving their tax increases.
Okay, and Representative Winkler had a question, and then Representative Hornstein.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Downey, I think if the testimony from NIOP and their work is that they'd like to move from slide 5 to slide 6, and you're trying to tell us that slide 5 is unintelligible and slide 6 is perfectly lucid to the average taxpayer, I think that is blatantly untrue. And I think the local governments have come forward with a lot of very legitimate reasons to be concerned about your bill. As in its current form, and it isn't just excuses because they don't want to do something. I think there is room for improvement on both sides, but it seems to me that based on your concluding comments, your goal is to pass a bill as is rather than work together, and I suspect it will be yet another waste of time that we've seen time after time, bill after bill. This session will have another one on rulemaking that will be a complete waste of everyone's time because it's not going to go anywhere instead of actually trying to do something to improve the state. And if that's what you want to end this session on and go into the summer and fall, terrific, but you're not going to get very far with it.
Madam Chair, just a quick clarification. The bill actually prescribes both slide 5 and 6, so it's not replacing one with the other. It's actually requires the presentation of both scenarios.
Okay, Representative Hornstein.
Hi, thank you.
Hi, Representative Bernstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's been so long. It's been a long hearing. But thank you, Madam Chair. You know, Representative Simon made a point that I think just deserves to be underlined and little exclamation point by it, too, because I think it's really philosophically, I think, deserves a lot of attention. And that is, he said that we don't seem to be giving the private sector monies that government is spending, whether be it at the subsidies at the local, state, and especially federal level, the same kind of scrutiny. And so, you know, I feel that there's kind of a double standard at play here, you know, that we're focusing on local government and the public sector, but we have, I think, a lot of sunshine and a lot of accountability that has to go in all the private sector funding that we're giving. And you know, Representative Beard talked about, you know, the captains of industry, and we've heaped a lot of largesse on captains of industry, whether it's at the federal level or the state and local. And so I think that, you know, philosophically, the idea of simplifying information and getting it out there, of course, but, you know, I agree with Representative Winkler, it's just done in such a partisan way and with such a double standard that, you know, I don't think this is a real serious effort, and I'm going to vote no.
I don't know if we're going to come to an agreement on this one, so perhaps it's time to just move to a vote. There's no further questions. I have to amend my earlier motion. I move that it go to taxes, and staff informed us they found a section that will require this to go to state government finance next. So, what was that? So for all of you on state government finance, you'll get to hear more on in an upcoming hearing. So I will amend my motion that that House File 1954 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to state government finance. All those in favor, please
Madam
signify
Chair,
by saying
we
aye.
We have roll call.
Aye.
A roll call roll having call. Been requested, there will be a roll call. And the clerk will take the roll.
Representative Pepin.
Aye.
Representative Murray.
Aye.
Representative Nelson.
No.
Representative Beard.
Aye.
Representative Green.
No.
Representative Hancock.
Aye.
Representative Hornstein.
No.
Representative McFarland.
Aye.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Aye.
Representative Simon.
No.
Representative Quam.
See.
Representative Sanders.
Aye.
Representative Scalzi.
No.
Representative Winkler.
No.
There being 8 ayes and 6 nays, the bill does prevail, and it will be re-referred to state government finance. Thank you. My intention is that we look at House File 2003, and then we will recess until 4:30, and please review your email. We will send out the room notification. And with that, if Representative Woodard could come up to the table and present House File 2003.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Woodard, this bill, I believe, needs to go to State Government Finance. Is that correct? Okay. I will move that House File 2003 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to State Government Finance. I'd like to start your testimony. That would be wonderful.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 2003 would allow both the lottery and the Minnesota Racing Commission to operate in case of a state government shutdown. Today, there are no general fund obligations for these two entities. They're all paid out of special revenue funds. These functions include things like veterinary services, stewards, and medical testing of our horses at the horse tracks. And these horse tracks and the related industries to them employ thousands of Minnesotans and provide revenue to the state even when the state is in a government shutdown. This bill would ensure that those entities remain operating. And, you know, the interesting thing about our horse tracks in particular are that when they're not operating, it affects our agricultural economy quite substantially. Because it's something our state depends on, from food, from feed suppliers to horse breeders to farmers. The thoroughbred and standardbred horse industry in Minnesota is one of the keys to our agricultural economy. So this bill would ensure that in the event of a state shutdown, those entities would still operate and our horse racing tracks and the lottery would still provide revenue to the state. Thank you, Madam Chair.
We've got a whole line of them. Oh, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Woodard. While I understand and I can sympathize with this, but as has been pointed out in the past, when we've had to the budget crisis that we've had in the time that I've been in the legislature and the tension that goes with that, this is just, it looks like we're putting government on autopilot, and so that we don't have to do this, and we're just letting stuff go on. I mean, this is the second bill I've heard in another committee that I've heard that, and I don't know if that's what your intention is, that we just put government on autopilot, and so we don't have to make tough decisions. And I understand, like I said, there's no implications here to the general fund and to approving funding for these, but I guess that's a concern I have, is that how many more bills are we going to have to carve out different parts of government and put them on continuing resolutions and put them on autopilot so that we don't have to make the decisions that we were elected and hired to do?
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Nelson, I have no idea how many other bills you will be hearing on this particular issue. This bill in particular, though, does say that our horse racing tracks and the Minnesota Lottery have no general fund implications and should remain operating in the event of a government shutdown. I don't think any of us would predict that we're going to have an annual government shutdown or a semi-annual government shutdown. We also don't predict that it's going to, if that does occur, that it would be a long one. But this does allow, especially in this instance, our racing community, our horse breeding community, to ensure that we have a stable business here in Minnesota. And we don't want to have a reputation amongst throughout the nation with our horse breeders, that this is not an area where you can bring your horses to race because it's subject to every 2 years a shutdown.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to that point, you know, we have a bill we're hearing in transportation similar, Representative Beard's bill, which I think he raises good points, as you do. You know, we have huge parts of the health and education budgets that are from federal pots of money that aren't the general fund and other monies here and there. And so, you know, to Representative Nelson's point, if we're going to just sort of piecemeal segregate out different parts of the budget and say, okay, you know, that they'll continue on in the event of a state government shutdown, why not do a continuing resolution? I don't want to do an ad for House Research, but I think all of us got in our inbox the last couple of days a House Research bill brief about how other states are doing continuing resolutions. And, you know, we were proposing that in 2005 on the DFL side when there was a Republican governor. That's how we should handle it. You had did that this last year. And so it's going to happen depending on what party the governor is and the legislative majority is in the event of a shutdown. So, you know, I get that. But would you feel that we should go in that direction of just an overall, you know, continuing resolution? Because this seems to be what we're going to see here in this session, is parsing different parts of the budget that aren't in the general fund and say, okay, well, you can continue on while we have a government shutdown. Do you have thoughts about that?
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hornstein, I think it's an important question, isn't it? And I would say that in some circumstances, this being one, that the legislature needs to take a proactive approach here, because in the event of a state shutdown, what we identify is that the courts take over and the courts determine what the priorities are. So in this case, because this has no general fund obligations and it has tremendous impact on our agricultural community, that this is one that that I would say is very important to us that we continue in the event of a shutdown.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Woodard, so is one of the reasons this bill is before this committee because of the Racing Commission's regulatory oversight duties? And it's kind of, I mean, this looks largely like a finance bill, but is it this part of the oversight of the Racing Commission and the operations of the lottery and any and how the lottery operates? Are those reasons why this bill is in this committee?
Representative Woodard.
Madam Chair, I would venture to guess that's correct, Representative Winkler. We do have the head of the Minnesota Racing Commission here to testify to the regulatory pieces of their work, but I think that's a fair assumption.
Well, would you like that, Representative Winkler?
No, Madam Chair, I don't think that's necessary. I guess what I question back to Representative Woodard is if this bill were to dramatically expand the scope of oversight obligations for the Racing Commission or to change substantially lottery operations, would it have to come back to this committee, you think, if it changed significantly from this form?
Representative Woodard.
Representative Winkler, I would, and Madam Chair, I would guess that would be correct. If it substantial changes to the operations, any changes that were made in a future committee, if I'm sure it's at the behest of the chair, if she wants to hear them again.
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Woodard, then I guess if this bill were to somehow to become a vehicle bill for a Racino amendment, which it seems like it's well set up to do, I assume it would have to come back to this committee to be heard before it would go further, regardless of where it was amended?
Representative Woodard.
Madam Chair and Representative Winkler, I would consider that a friendly amendment, but I assume that amendment is not on the table. And yes, absolutely. If it, that is not the intent of this bill, Representative Winkler. And if that were to happen, of course, it would have to come back. And I'm sure Madam Chair would agree with that. That is not the intention of this bill.
Madam Chair, Representative Woodard, I didn't say that it was, but just in case, I just would like to note that it's Valentine's Day, 12 noon, and it'll be pretty easy to remember the time and place that you made that commitment, so I'll be able to remember that should the time come.
Yes, happy Valentine's Day, Representative Winkler. We will move on to Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I hadn't even considered that. Thank you for the suggestion, Representative. And I, too, would consider it a friendly amendment. However, I just want to make a comment here, since I'm one of the few around this table that have probably actually been through gambler managers training over at the Gambling Control Board. Boy, there's something you ought to send some people to every once in a while. It would make us better legislators. But I just want to note, folks, that there has been some discussion with the Gambling Control Board, which also operates almost completely autonomously of anything we do around here to regulate charitable gaming, that they would like to have an amendment to be considered in your House File 2003. It didn't meet the drafting deadlines, and the amendment I'm looking at, Mr. Shepard tells me, is actually doesn't do what they hope anyhow. So I would hope that if this bill moves to state government finance, perhaps we can have that discussion there. I am not on that committee, so I'll leave that to my colleagues who are on the state government finance to actually take that issue up. But I wanted to note it.
Thank you. And I see that you want Mr. Holton to testify. Is that who you had wanted to testify?
Well, I think we're probably okay. If Mr. Holton, if you'd like to testify, you can. If not, we're okay. He looks like okay. He's okay. And Madam Chair, just for a point here on, we do have an amendment, the A1 amendment. And
I
was
that.
Remiss in mentioning that. It changes some of the language based on some discussions with the Senate to clean that up. Is that, Rory, do you have the A1 amendment?
I do not.
Okay, so this may have already been incorporated.
No. The next committee. I'm not aware of it.
Okay.
Would it be possible to amend it in the next committee?
Yes,
since we don't have a copy of that?
Yeah, that's fine. We will do that.
Unless it's oral,
I'll talk
something
to
very short.
I'll talk to Rory afterwards to make sure that we...
Okay. Representative Nelson.
Just, Madam Chair, seeing as I don't sit on the government, State Government Finance Committee, what is the nature of the A1 amendment so that...
Good question. Representative Woodard.
Because if it has to come back here, if that affects something we do here...
Well, and so, Rory, I apologize for that. I think I may have gotten the wrong amendment, and that it had already been incorporated, but it basically is in line 1.18 and says if a fiscal, beginning with 1.18, if a fiscal biennium ends without the enactment of an appropriation to the commission for the following biennium, receipts in this account are annually appropriated to the commission for the operations of the commission.
Do you have a copy of the draft?
I do.
If it would be okay, we could recess for a few minutes till we get a copy of it, unless you'd...
I just want to know what it was.
It's nothing, I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
Nothing
nefarious at all in its inner order.
I guess I'll take suggestions. Would you like to recess, or would you just like to have that reread?
Madam Chair.
Representative Garrett.
It strikes me that's actually a financial portion of the bill and probably be handled the next committee with complete transparency and openness. So,
yeah,
rather
right.
than.
Madam Chair, I agree.
Would that be okay?
I just wanted to know what it was, if it was something we had purview over.
Okay. Okay, then I guess we'll just. The consensus seems to be that it can be handled in state government finance. Is there any other questions before we move to a vote here? Okay. Seeing no other questions, I will renew my motion that House File 2003 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay.
No.
Motion does prevail, and we will, as I mentioned earlier, we will be recessing until 4:30, and we will come back and try to handle the last bill. I don't know exactly where the room will be, so please check your email, and hopefully we can carry on with that bill and get that done. Meeting recess.
State Gov Ops, and we'll go ahead and reconvene our meeting. We have before us this afternoon House File 2211, Representative Swedzinski, and Representative Sanders. Would you like to move this bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I recommend that House File 2211 be passed and sent to State Government Finance.
Okay. And I understand you have an author's amendment that you would like to look at first, so could you tell us about that, please?
Well, the author amendment is pretty much a delete-all amendment, so if we could just have that adopted so we can kind of get the bill in the form that it's ready to go. Okay. So.
All right. Are there any questions? Anybody have any discussion on the DE1 amendment?
Mr. Chair, I'll move the DE1 amendment as well.
Okay. Any questions? Seeing none, all in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment is hereby adopted, and the bill is in the order you'd like. Proceed, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Committee. As I attended meetings this summer and fall with constituents in my district and people across the state, I heard many ideas of reform and redesign, but one issue kept creeping into the conversation among business owners, ag folks, individuals about stop changing the rules. And House File 2211 simply pushes the pause button on state agency rulemaking to allow our state's job creators to take a break from the time-consuming duty to conform into new rules. We need to provide our job creators with certainty, a bit of clarity. This will allow them to focus on expanding their business, hire more workers, and become more competitive. With our state and nation slowly making a recovery, it's my belief that House File 2211 is a relief we need to push job growth. In crafting this bill, we have created a few common sense exemptions to this moratorium to give state agencies the wiggle room that they need. The good cause exemption in Chapter 14, 3338, in times of serious, some of these exemptions to this pause, in times of serious and immediate threat to public health, safety, and welfare, compliance with a court order or a requirement in federal law relating to incorporation of specific changes set forth in statute and relating to changes that do not alter the sense, meaning, or side effect of the rule. This bill sends an instant message to job creators that we as a state are serious about making the state one of the best places to do business. With that, I can be open to questions, or I do have Judge Eric Lippman to just talk in general about some rules and some of the processes that happen.
Do any of the members have questions at this time, or should we go ahead and proceed with the testifier? Okay, let's go ahead with Judge Lippman. Do we have one here?
Representative McFarland, did you have a question?
Well, I guess if it's okay to ask it now.
Go ahead.
Sure. I'm just wanting, Mr. Chair and Representative Swadzinski, does this include things that were passed in this current biennium then that we would get no rulemaking?
Well, I think the law is set to take effect in July of this year. And so if it depends on how specific we were with those rule changes and how pinpointing we were when we were delegating changes to the agencies. So that's the main analysis that needs to get done. So,
okay. All right, Judge Lippman, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Eric Lippman. I'm the Assistant Chief Administrative Law Judge for Administrative Law at Minnesota's Office of Administrative Hearings. I didn't have any particular testimony on this particular bill. As you know, judges of the OAH are glad to be a resource to members, but we never testify either for or against any particular legislation. But given the fact that Chapter 14 tends to be a very complicated area of the law, I'm glad to be a resource if anybody has any questions about the general process or what I understand the DE amendment to do or any other feature about our work in doing the legal review of rules that are promulgated or proposed to be promulgated by state agencies.
Okay. Any questions from the members? Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering how this would affect your, you had a bill before us, I think it was House File 1926, that had some rulemaking in it. How would this new moratorium affect your bill?
Well, my bill, it was 1926. That focused on essentially creating rules that we were to adopt specifically. So this wasn't a shall or a may. This was specific rules that we were going to direct the Department of Agriculture to do specific inspections that had this direct outcome. And also, and those were to take immediate. So upon passage, which would be hopefully fairly soon, as soon as the process gets going and signed into law, it would take effect immediately. So it would be done prior to the implementation of this law, but also my particular bill has a portion of it that as soon as the feds do come out with their rulemaking authority, we simply adopt those rules. And so because of the portion relating to incorporation of specific changes set forth in statute, but also compliance with court order, talking about federal law. So that wouldn't particularly be affected by this bill, I believe. So.
Everybody check their phone, please.
Yeah.
Make sure.
I don't know what happens when you don't have rules.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Horvath, for that.
Just saying.
Was there a follow-up?
No.
Any other questions from the members?
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Representative?
It was pointed out to me, and I'm not the expert on this, but it's pointed out to me that we already have the ability to suspend rules as a committee, that the legislature can stop rules that have already been are supposed to go into effect, that we can stop those and have hearings on them. And so why are we having to go above and beyond that? I mean, are we not doing that? Are we not doing our job? And I'm a little confused, too, because of last week, again, you said you were for making rules for this instance, but now we want to stop all other rulemaking. So that has me confused also. So I guess that's my two questions I got right now.
Well,
Representative Swadzinski.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I think the focus of this bill is simply to put a pause on just general making rule authority. So it's my belief that the legislature has been dictated to have the law rulemaking authority, and we've essentially licensed it out to our agencies at our will. And, you know, the conversations that I've had across the state, that folks feel that maybe there's some potential for us. I do feel that with the legislature is a very wide open process, the way we create rules, and I believe there is room for that also within the state agencies and the way they promulgate rules. And you know, this is simply to kind of give a little bit of a breather. You know, I believe we're freshly coming out of a recession, hopefully on the move towards total recovery in our economy. And, you know, that it's just the mindset and the idea that there's potential damage with, and just trying to pull that back into the legislature as much as possible.
Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Swedinsky, I guess, again, that's got me confused because, again, last week we were here trying to make rules to help businesses in our state because they need to make the rules, and now we're saying that rules are bad and we don't want to stop making any or changing any rules, and I understand that, but there are things I know that come up. The building codes and stuff like that, some of that stuff changes that we have to make those rules, otherwise, you know, we can have problems having buildings that are out of compliance. So I guess there's a lot of this stuff. Like I said, we're either for rules as we were last week to help businesses, or now we're against rules because we're trying to help business. And I guess that's my confusion: is where are we at? I mean, I'm confused that way.
Well, I think, you know, Mr. Chair, the bill that I carried last week, I think that's what you're referring to, is what were for the rules. I think those rules were born from a legislative process. You know, that's a bill that I was carrying that we created with the state agency in close contact, and move those bills through the process, talking to business, seeing exactly what the need was, seeing where there was potential fault in the process, and move that bill forward. And I think that's what this bill continually can do, is really put a stronger emphasis on that ability to work with a state agencies and the legislature, and trying to bridge that gap that at times may be felt. And, you know, for instance, just last week I was visiting with a constituent of mine, who is a manufacturer down in Lyon County, Minnesota. A state agency came down with some fresh rules that made sense on the outside. But the practicality of testing, the practicality of, because he manufactures in the outdoors, the manufacturing practice and the new testing that he needs to have done by April used water. And as you know, when you go outside, you might slip and fall. And simply his conversation with the agency was falling on deaf ears. He was told, could we simply push back the due date of this requirement so that I can actually sell the products that I produce? And he was told by the state agency head, who was in charge of implementing this rule, that why don't you just manufacture your goods indoors rather than trying to simply deal with the fact that, you know, there are certain realities of manufacturing outdoors and dealing with water and water testing, that anything below zero. And, you know, I think that's what potentially some of this is born out of, is because instead of going to the state agency, yes, there are rules and there are certain instances where that person can have reprieve within the agency. Ultimately, they do come to the legislature for some sort of relief.
Hey, follow-up, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess that's where my understanding, I mean, my confusion is, because it's my understanding, we have that ability now. Mm-hmm. If that manufacturer came to his representative and said, this rule is really bad, this is the problem it's causing, he could bring it to us as the legislature, and we could stop that rule right now and review that, and so he wouldn't be affected by that until we make a decision that, yes, it can go forward. And so I guess I hear this all the time, too, which is, you know, we got rules that the rules are bad, and we just got to get rid of these rules and we can operate. But I ask, what rules? Give me a specific example of a rule, and if that's a specific example, what rule that is, that he should have brought it to you as his legislature, and you should have brought that forward and said, this is a rule we need to look at, and we should be looking at that rule and seeing, okay, is it right, is it wrong, and stopping it till we either pass it or after the legislative session is over, then it would go back into effect. But that's something, like I said, I think this is a little bit going beyond what we need to do because we already have this ability.
Representative, thank you. Okay. Representative Hornstein.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think Representative Simon, would it be better for you to ask your question?
Can we swap?
Go ahead. Yes. Sure.
Sorry,
sure.
I have to run out for a second after this.
You have a date back tonight, in time, right? Huh?
Back in time, too. It's not a Valentine's Day related, I can promise you. thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it. And Representative Hornstein. Representative Swedzinski, as I'm sure you know, this is one of several, at least three or four, rulemaking bills, I guess, that have come to before us or that will be coming before us. So, I mean, one thing to think about, I think, for all of us is how do these interact? Which is kind of the superseding bill? Is it this bill, which is a total holiday, or is it the other bills that enable us to kind of intervene in the process? You know, I'm not sure if you could comment at some point about the interplay there. One is going to have to yield to the other. I don't think we can all, I think some of them are mutually exclusive. I don't think we can do all of them at the same time. So I don't know if you have any insight about that for us. The other thing, though, that I think is worth repeating that we discussed last week is that, you know, rules don't just spring up. We enable the rulemaking process here in the legislature. It's not as if the Pollution Control Agency or Department of Labor and Industry or others just decide one day to do an administrative rule. I know you know that, but it's worth repeating, I think, that they only engage in rulemaking when we, by statute, tell them, go write a rule. So some of these bills, to me, have the feeling of sort of stop me before I kill again, sort of saving the world from our own actions. I mean, we have the power to just not do rulemaking, to tell agencies that they ought not to do it or to not authorize it. And I guess that leads me to my next point, is it seems to me that there has to be a more surgical, precise approach than an outright two-year ban. I mean, I don't doubt that you hear from constituents, as we all do, that feel overburdened by rules, by regulations that they deem unreasonable or ill-founded or whatever. And maybe in that specific instance, as Representative Nelson was saying, there's some remedy here. Maybe we can kind of pull things back. I just don't know that a two-year holiday in every area of state law, whether it's the Department of Labor and Industry or Agriculture or PCA or Veterans Affairs or whatever, across all agencies, you may not make rules. I just don't know why would we do that. It seems like a possible overreaction. I guess the final thing I would say is, as someone else alluded to here today, at least in my experience, there are some businesses that want rulemaking in either a particular instance or generally in a particular area of the economy because it's in their interest, and they think that it creates jobs. Maybe because it levels the playing field, maybe because it provides clarity to them or their competitors or their consumers. But in my experience, at least in my law practice, I've encountered businesses, large Minnesota businesses, that actually want and campaign for and push for certain rules. So, you know, we both have our individual experiences and anecdotes we can retell. I'm just a little wary of a one-size-fits-all total ban for 2 years. I know you have some exceptions here, but it would amount to pretty close to a total ban. So I've talked long enough. I guess the first point I maybe merits coming back to, which is could you tell the committee a little bit more about the interplay between and among these various rulemaking bills?
Representative Swazinski.
Chair Murray, Representative Simon, you know, as far as the interplay and kind of, you know, I believe this bill probably is, has a foundation built and I think has room to grow. As far as the other bills are concerned, you know, I'm not exactly sure where they're at. I believe Representative Beard is potentially carrying a bill. As far as I'm concerned, you know, this has been my focus. This has been my bill, my focus. And as far as its interaction with other bills, I guess I can't speak to that. Appreciate your thoughts, though, on this issue. So,
follow up, okay. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Swazinski. Just a couple of things. I know if Representative Beard was here, he would probably raise a little concerns about 1.4 through 1.6. He has trained me well to be a little wary about bills of state legislative intention. So, I'm particularly concerned about this because I think this only talks about business, where in fact we have so many more constituencies that are either concerned about rules or may want rules. And so I just caution a little on that, and maybe, I'll check in with Representative Beard, and you can too, and see what he thinks. But I had very similar concerns to Representative Simon, and you know, this is, I can think of an example when I was, we were doing some amendments to the Waste Management Act, for example, or the Waste Management Hierarchy a couple of years ago, and we had people from Waste Management Incorporating wanting us to not act on the amendment that I wanted to do until rules were promulgated for composting. So, I mean, Representative Simon's right, and we can probably cite a number of other ways in which business actually wanted rulemaking. But my question to you, Representative, is President Obama, in a State of the Union address, took on this issue as well. Maybe he framed it in terms of regulations, but it could have been a federal rulemaking. And it cited some rules that he thought were, you know, outdated or not particularly helpful. But then he also cited the fact that we need some regulation as well. And picking up on what Representative Winkler said, this doesn't necessarily have to be a partisan issue or a polarizing issue. I think the president himself addressed, I think, some of the concerns you're raising. Are you familiar with what he's proposing at the federal level, and do you think there's any applicability here? Because I worry that this is, you know, again, all Republican sponsors. I think it's pretty polarizing. But, you know, maybe the president is offering us a way out of this in terms of something that could be a little more bipartisan that we could all agree to. I just heard the State of the Union. I don't know if there's a document he's referring to or something that his administration is proposing. Are you familiar with that?
Representative? Chair Murray, Representative Hornstein, I think I have not personally listened to it. I would be very inquisitive to that as well. So if there's a way that we can dovetail that, so maybe that's a direction we can go.
I'll try to find the exact passage and send it along to you, because maybe there's something worth pursuing there that we could use as a model for something a little more bipartisan.
Sure.
All right. Thank you. Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have one kind of little rulemaking process that I've been somewhat involved with in my district. We have Lake Owosso, which, because of rising and lowering water levels, the weeds grow. I call them weeds, but they're actually aquatic vegetation. And some of the people around that lake would like to just kill it all off. And the DNR, in their wisdom, decides that aquatic vegetation is good for fish. If you don't ever want to fish again, you could kill it all, and that would be one outcome. But so they had like a 2-year rulemaking process. It seems to me about 2 years. I don't know if it was or not, but many, many meetings with many people. And I don't think they actually progressed that rule. But how would you feel about that? I mean, if we don't do the rule, then people can do whatever they want. And then pretty soon you don't have any fish, and then they're going to be complaining because they don't have any fish. How would you feel about that? And it's important in my district. And I always assume that the DNR is doing their job. And I don't want to have to determine which of these little microscopic things feed fish and how they grow and how they're affected by chemicals. But how would you address that if we don't have any rules?
Representative Swazinski.
Chair Murray, Representative Scalzi, I don't think, you know, the issue isn't that we're not going to have rules. It's just the way that the rules get promulgated will first come to, as you would probably represent the Lake Association, and the process that they're dealing with as far as the rule. It's been going on for 2 years. Whether they come to a conclusion and decide what's the set that they would want to go for, you know, just in the next 2 years while we have this pause in rulemaking, that would be something that we could set up in statute. That, you know, a representative from the area could potentially take and move forward through the House and the Senate and get signed by the governor. So I don't say that that's bad or any. I just say that's the process that would, I think, naturally come before us, rather than it just be simply, you know, obviously I think the argument can be made that there's been time and there's been thought put into that. You've brought the folks together that are affected by this issue, dealt and visited with the agency, the DNR, came to some conclusion, and rather than it just simply go forward from that standpoint, it would have the potential for you to come to a bill. So.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Scalzi.
Maybe I didn't phrase it right. They've done all that. Sure. The DNR has done that. They've had the meetings. They've solicited responses. Half the people on the lake want to kill every vegetation in there, and half the people want to be stewards of the water for the future. And this is just one little lake. I mean, there's, you know, 15,000 in Minnesota. So I just don't see the legislature wanting to go through this. I wouldn't want to go through it and tell half of my constituents that they're right and half are wrong. That would be the wrong thing for me to do. But the DNR, I trust them because they have the expertise. I don't have the expertise, and neither do the lakeshore owners. The DNR has the people who have studied this, and I just don't think that this is the kind of thing that I would trust myself to make a rule on, or anybody on this in this committee. We just don't have the expertise. But then the other thing I'd like to ask about, too, I mean, I've got a property on Lake Mille Lacs. I can only take a fish this size. I can't take a little fish. I can't take a big fish. I trust the DNR to do that. And they do it because of spawning controls, because of size of fish do certain things. And I don't want to have to study that. And we shouldn't be depending on legislators who are elected for many different reasons, but not for what fish can we keep. I mean, this is so overreaching that I think it would be really a disaster for our fish population, and that's just one little microcosm. It just could be a disaster.
Representative Swazinski.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scalzi, I've had a brief conversation earlier today with members of DNR, Bob Meyer, and you know, I believe that there may be potential for looking at issues when it comes to fish management, when it comes to those things of finding, I mean, there are exemptions maybe that we can find in specific areas that we can agree on to find some middle ground. So I appreciate your thoughts. And I'm sure Mr. Meyer will probably be coming up and visiting with us as well. So.
Okay. Judge Lippman, do you have anything to add at this point?
I don't. I just wanted to make myself available, Mr. Chairman, members, if there are questions on Chapter 14.
Okay, I think we'll ask then, if questions are done here, we'd ask Bob Meyer to come forward and give his testimony. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you. For the record, Bob Meyer, Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. And before I get to the specifics, I just want to talk generally a little bit. I've been asked by the governor's office just to make a couple quick comments for some of the agencies. Commissioner Peterson's here as well, but rather than have all the agencies come here and talk about the impacts, we're trying to use our time wisely because there are many different issues going on. One of the things I did hand out was a letter the governor sent last April regarding a veto of a bill at that time, which required, talked about legislative approval to rules to take, for rules to take effect. Kind of along Representative Nelson's comments, currently the legislature has the authority to change or amend an existing rule through legislation. Existing law, which allows the legislature to essentially override any rule passed by any agency, would seem to provide ample protections against overly burdensome or unnecessary rules. This already is in existence, and it's the fourth paragraph on the letter there. So the legislature does have that authority. And then I just want to go to the last sentence of Governor Dayton's letter, where he says he will strongly safeguard the long-established principles of executive agency rulemaking and regulatory authority. The rulemaking and regulatory authority of the agency is very important to us. At a time where we're talking about jobs, about protecting jobs, growing the economy, in the Environment Committee we're talking about environmental permitting, which will require rules probably. We want to do good rules to remove problems that we can say yes to faster on permitting issues. We can talk about doing things differently and being more efficient. This bill will prohibit us from doing that. Governor Dayton has empowered his cabinet to undertake a continuous improvement process, looking at the issues within state government and agencies and remove barriers to commerce wherever possible. This bill will prohibit us from doing that. It stops bad rules probably, there might be a couple out there, but it also stops all of the good rules we're trying to do as well. So with that, I've also included a copy of a letter dated May 27th, 2003 from then-Governor Pawlenty talking about the same types of issues. I mean, this is a cyclical kind of discussion we have here. Specifically with the DNR, the bill and the amendment would prohibit us from establishing any hunting or fishing seasons. We do all of our quotas, dates, numbers of harvest, all of the, for the deer hunters or people who have ever gone deer hunting, there's a map with zones. We do all of that through the rulemaking process. It's expedited in Chapter 84, but we establish all the quotas and seasons and dates via rulemaking process, so that would cease to exist for a period of 2 years. And it seems on the amendment, the language, and actually, make sure I have the right language. I have the Senate amendment, but I believe it's the same thing. On lines 1.14, relating to incorporation of specific changes set forth in statute, It's merely a restatement of the good clause exemption, where if a bill passes that contradicts a rule piece, you get the good clause exemption, and you can change that rule to codify it with the current statute. So it does clamp us down really hard for the next 2 years. I think if there are bad rules, let's talk about them and get rid of them and move forward. But let's not stop innovation from the governor, from the executive branch, and from the legislature to take place. It's too important work that we have to do. So thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Meyer. We have a couple questions. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Some brief comments. First of all, one piece of legislation that I'm currently working on will deal with a website to track what's happening with rules, and so that you can follow them through from the beginning to the end. But it does not address a concern that I have, and that is this. And maybe I've said this before, I don't remember. But you're used to hearing my stories twice anyway. When I find someone saying to me, a constituent or something, that what have you done to us? What law did you pass? Now I've got to do this. Now my business is affected this way, or now I have this other concern over here. And I realize that we didn't pass a law dealing with that. That came about because of rulemaking.
We heard this.
I know, but it's still good.
Is that how many times?
It's only twice now.
Three.
But I don't think Mr. Meyer has heard this. Anyway,
sorry.
There's a new audience, guys. Just work with me here.
Here comes a cheeseburger.
But anyway, the point is that rules are being made that have the impact of law, and we don't know about them until after the fact. I wish that there were a way that at least we would know, ahead of time that this is happening.
Mr. Meyer.
Chair, Representative Erdahl, just very briefly, we keep our rulemaking docket up to date on our website. The rulemaking process that we're involved with contains numerous opportunities for public comment and input. We reach out to different communities that are impacted to make sure that they do know. So you're absolutely right. People need to be involved in understanding the rules that are being developed, and sometimes that takes longer than some of the allotted time frame that we have for rulemaking, which is a problem in a different part of Chapter 14, which I'm not going to bring up today. Those are great points and very, very well stated. We need to make sure people know what's going on.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will say that I made them under medication today, so I'm not remembering what I said before.
Representative Quam.
Mr. Chair, members, and just a couple of the members are on the Energy Natural Resources Committee. But when we were discussing the hunting and trapping of wolves, in that bill there is appropriate delegation for the DNR to set up the season. We haven't completed that yet, but the appropriate way for us to do that, because rules are written to implement the law, and we should not be lazy by not putting in there the appropriate direction to implement the law and have the agency write the rules. And I see if we do our job, there would not be any real impact from this piece of legislation, because we should be very careful. And too many times, I'm just a freshman, and too many times I've heard a chair or a ranking member say to an agency person, that is not what the legislative intent was. And I think we need to be clearer when we dictate and hand off and delegate that rulemaking. And so I don't see there being any issue as long as we do the appropriate legislative action, so the DNR wouldn't have to worry about not being able to set the hunting seasons and et cetera, because that'd be appropriately delineated. So I support the idea of additional rulemaking that maybe not directly relational to the statutes that we debate, discuss, vote on, and pass. And then the governor signs. Just my input.
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, related just to the game and fish rulemaking that we do, the legislature sets the framework, so to speak. I don't think there's enough legislative days available to have debate the number of walleyes on certain lakes or the days you should be able to take deer or where those zones are. Those are things that we try to work on with the consent and approval of the legislature that's there. And related to the other part, I'm just making sure you folks understand this bill would prohibit the DNR from doing those activities the way it's currently drafted with the amendment.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, if we delegate in there the the limits or the licensing, etc., as give you that authority, we don't have to say how many I's and T's and etc. in there. We're giving you the authority, as with the new wolf season. We're not doing all the minutia, but we're setting a framework and saying you take that and implement it, and that's the appropriate way. And I'm not a person for overly tweaking, but again, we shouldn't be lazy and not give you sufficient direction to where we then have to ask you to come back and say, this was not our intent. So, thank you.
Mr. Meyer?
Mr. Chair, we appreciate that. And again, the amendment that you have before you in this bill would prohibit us from doing any rulemaking just because the good cause exemption, serious and immediate threat to public health, safety, or welfare relating to compliance with the court order or requirement in federal law relating to incorporation of specific changes set forth in statute, and relating to changes that do not alter the sense, meaning, or effect, it doesn't provide us with the ability to do those rules that may be set out in framework, at least the way I'm reading the language and talking with staff.
Okay. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Myers, I hear you, I believe I heard you right. So if we pass this legislation as it's amended, that'll strip the DNR of their ability to set the deer hunting season, the fishing season, the slot limits on Lake Mille Lacs, and I know I've come sometimes in the middle of the season they've had to change those slot limits because of the number, the amount of taking. So that would all be stopped for 2 years. So what you're saying is we'd not be able to have a deer hunting season this fall and next fall. Is that am I hearing that correctly, Mr. Myers?
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, yes.
So for Mr. Chairman, I guess for that alone, as an avid deer hunter that I am, I guess for that alone I would have to oppose this bill.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Meyer, would not those regulations be able to be in a game and fish bill? Couldn't you put it in the game and fish bill, the hunting season and whatnot? Is there something that would prevent that from being included in that bill?
Representative Pepin, the game of fish bill would be very long and technical, and trying to get through something like that, talking about borders, and I could share with members a copy of our rulemaking documents that we use for hunting or fishing season. It's pretty complicated and complex. And sometimes those issues, when you bring them forward into the legislature, don't always end up the way that they've been introduced. So it would take a lot of work, and we would have to do it every year, and it's just not as effective as doing it through the expedited rulemaking authority that we have in Chapter 84. We've been delegated special rulemaking authority that's separate from any agency to deal with these specific issues, because the legislature has set that framework for us to do that, and it trust that process works. So the setting of, I'll take the bear season, for example, the number of animals that will be able to be harvested in each area, each lottery zone, and the number of participants. Sometimes we may not know that until after the legislative session is out. We usually don't post that information. The lottery is available early May. It's not selected until June. I think the example of the Mille Lacs harvest, which usually occurs, blinks on or off July, June 30th, July 1st, we certainly wouldn't be able to deal with that issue. The obvious thing, we would probably just have to shut down fishing for the rest of the year if we couldn't deal with that because of some tribal and court situations we have on that situation. So to your question, it could be done. What that would look like, I'm not sure how long that would take.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you. I just wanted to make the point that Representative Nelson, his last comments, I just wanted to make it clear that it would be possible to get it done. I think you said something about it being too complicated for the legislature, and I think we're all pretty intelligent in the legislature, and I think we could get it done. It might not be as easy as the rulemaking process, but it certainly wouldn't be impossible. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pepin, no, it wouldn't be.
Thank you.
Okay. Any additional questions for this testifier? Hearing none, why don't we call on Commissioner Peterson?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Commissioner, welcome to the committee, and please state your name and proceed.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Ken Peterson. I'm Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry. Thank you for allowing me to testify today on this bill. I just want to go through how it applied to us. I'll do some general comments first, and then how it applied to our department, how we approach rulemaking, sort of things we do. I guess my first comment is you don't need this bill. You already have the means, I think, to take care of it. The administration's position is you do have the means to withdraw rules, repeal rules. I think you could rejuvenate that Committee on Administrative Rules and Regulations. You could add some staff to that. You could ask departments to submit their rules to the chairs before they're approved. Give them 30 days or 90 days to look at them. There are a variety of ways you could deal with this. I think this is a reach. This is going too far. And my reason for that is I think there are very good reasons for this bill, though. I mean, every one of us is sympathetic to what we see sometimes as a long arm of government, somehow kind of screwing around with us. In the Senate committee, they had a hearing on this bill. We had a restaurateur from Rochester who said he had an electrical inspector came and made him put a shield on a bulb that was 14 feet high that wasn't going to be a danger to anybody. We went back and checked, and we just found out we had an overzealous inspector, that he shouldn't have done it, but he was just being overzealous. And so, you know, that can happen. And it's always regrettable, but we're all born into sin. We do make mistakes, even state inspectors. So we do sometimes make these mistakes, and so we're very sympathetic. But I think this bill goes a little too far. My reason for it is we've got in our department, we do bills, we do rules. We basically do it in conjunction with the community of people we're working with, if they're plumbers, plumbing contractors and plumbers and others, or electrical rules. We're doing one right now without talking, working with. If they're plumbers, plumbing contractors and plumbers and others, or electrical rules, we're doing one right now, which I'll talk about in a minute, with the building code. We've got something like 150 volunteers sitting on 10 different committees, and then about another 100, 200 people coming to regular meetings giving input. And they're dealing with very complex matters, trying to update our building codes. And I don't think you'd want to, you certainly could, as Representative Pepin pointed out, you certainly could pass legislation on this stuff. I don't think you really want to get into this. Some of this stuff really does rely upon expertise of people in a given field who really know what they're doing and try to work out what's best for the industry. The rules, we've got five or six that we're looking at for the next 2 years. Three of them in the workers' comp area, and three of them are in what we call our construction codes and licensing division. The workers' comp ones are all basically mandated. We need to do them. As you all probably know, I don't know if many of you have been in the workers' comp committees, but or the labor committees, but the way workers' comp works is it's a completely regulated system. There's a trade-off that goes on between business and labor that was made 100 years ago that every business becomes, agrees to get workers' comp insurance, and then on the other hand, workers agree not to sue in district courts. And so it's a regulated field. So we have we control how much people get paid out on them. We try to control medical costs as much as we can, although we're not being as successful as we'd like. It is a regulated field. But we have one area where each year we update our fee schedule so that medical providers can recover their costs, their increased costs. Last year, I think we increased it something like 2.5% or 3%. The year before, it was done 2%. The year before that, it wasn't done at all because it wasn't an increase in cost. But it does accommodate their increased costs. This year, if we were unable to do it through rulemaking, we'll not be able to increase their costs. Worse, because of the way they wrote this rule 10, 15 years ago, the fee schedule rule is set up so it only takes place, runs from October 1st of each year to September 30th of the next year. So we renew the rule each year. And there's a rule calling for a fee schedule controlling the cost, the fees you can charge for everything but hospital care. So if we couldn't pass a rule, the fee schedule that controls providers' costs would just go out the window. And so presumably, if I'm a health care provider, I'm going to increase my cost on the one hand. If I'm an insurance company, I'm going to be seeing that happening. I'm going to raise my costs, and the business people are going to be paying higher premiums. Now, we can maybe do it. We may figure out a way at the end of the session to pass a bill. If this is going to act in law, maybe we can pass a bill working this out. But I can tell you there will be problems like this throughout state government, and I can see it happening in our department. It will cost money, and I don't think it'll be a consequence you want to do. You want to protect industry, and I think you're going to have the completely unintended effect of actually harming industry. Another area we work in is an even stranger one. It's called the diagnostic codes. That there's an interplay that goes on between Medicare and health, the rates, the diagnostic codes used by Medicare and the diagnostic codes used by others. Medicare dominates. Medicare rules, you can well imagine how much. And so Medicare is switching its diagnostic code to what they call IDC-10 from IDC-9. Our rules are full of IDC-9s. We have to, in order to accommodate the Medicare changes, which are going to be applied to every place, to all the hospitals and providers in the country, except for, interestingly enough, for workers' comp and auto, because they're regulated by the states. So we're going to, by rules, we're going to adopt the IDC-10. We won't be able to do that. And so then you could have, unless we figured out something, you could have the situation where a hospital, where they do like 3 or 4% of their work is on workers' comp, but they'll be using a different diagnostic code for workers' comp than they are for the other 96% of their work. That's just a ridiculous result. No one intends that. No one wants to do that. I understand that. But those are the potential consequences of doing something like this. Our other area that we're doing some rules in, right now we're working on the building code, as I pointed out earlier. We've got a lot of volunteers, people of lots of expertise, representing the various contractors, communities, mechanics, others, that know things about various issues they're working on. We're trying to put together, updating our building code. We didn't update it in 2009 with the international code. The department lacked the funds to do it, so we're still operating on 2006. So we will be adopting the 2012. And but be done by rules starting probably by the end of summer, we hope. That has been our plan, to do it by the end of the summer. And then it would take probably another 6 months to go into effect, January or March, sometime in there. That's our goal. And if this bill were to go into effect, we obviously could not adopt a new building code. And I'm not going to say it's going to be Armageddon or it's going to be an apocalypse if we don't adopt a new building code. But it will affect some businesses. They won't be able to buy the products as cheaply because they'll be using other specifications. It will affect some sellers of building materials. It will affect some safety. Probably, not a lot. I'm not going to say it's going to be the end of the world. I don't want to say that. But it will affect, it would be the detriment of some businesses. And I don't think it's going to be necessarily to the advantage of anybody. In one area you're going to have is that, this is sort of a crazy area, but these international codes, these associations, they print these books of to train people on what's in the code. Well, the 2006 code is going to go out of print within a year or two. So that means that we'll have to print our own code to give to people to enforce the code. So it's just these sort of really intricate little consequences that we don't want. I feel almost ridiculous bringing them to you. I'm trying to hone in on details when you're here to work on major issues. But I'm concerned that with the passage of this bill, you will have to look at, you'll either have to deal with those real minor issues, or you're going to have constituents and businesses, homeowners, consumers, they're going to be upset because of some small thing that they're saying government is screwing around them again. They won't even allow them to adopt a new building code. Or we have to go with the 2006 code while everybody in Wisconsin gets to use the 2012 code. That I can get better materials, I get up-to-date materials over Menards and Hudson that I can here. It's that sort of thing that I'm concerned about if you pass this bill. So I would caution you to at least try to find ways to accommodate it or take a look at it, or try to find other ways of repealing these rules, which I think we all agree. We maybe have too many rules. We maybe need to repeal some of them. But I don't think this is the way of doing it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, you haven't heard me before on this, have you?
No, I haven't. I wish I had.
Talking to a constituent.
Commissioner, just a couple of quick questions. First of all, you indicated over the next 2 years probably 5-6 new rules. The question is, do you have any idea, is that on the average what you do? I mean, how many new rules do you have in a year? Do you have any idea?
Commissioner Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, members, we have to do these work comp rules I mentioned. There's two of them we do in one proceeding. We have to do those every year. I suppose we probably do 2 or 3. The ones we'd be doing the next 2 years would be the building code, 2 plumbing code ones, which are starting right now, and then 3 workers' comp ones. 2 of them would be together, and the 3rd would be this diagnostic code. So I expect probably 2 or 3 a year. We don't do a lot of rulemaking. There was a lot of rulemaking done maybe after the 1995 changes in the workers, 96 changes in workers' comp law. I don't think we do a lot now.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Peterson, do you ever withdraw a rule?
Commissioner Peterson.
I was the commissioner of this department back in the 80s, and I don't recall withdrawing any then, and I've been commissioner now for a year. We haven't had any that I would withdraw, but I think if we sent one over to OEH and they came back and said, look bad, we'd withdraw it. I'd certainly not mind withdrawing it. Yeah, if you don't want to do that. You'd rather have headed off taking care of the problems earlier on, so you don't have a lot of people go through a lot of extra work. But yeah, I wouldn't mind withdrawing a rule. If it looked bad, I wouldn't mind withdrawing at all. I think this this bill calls for that, to withdraw them. And I think if a committee was well informed, discussed it, said this is a bad idea, or you shouldn't have this on the books, I wouldn't mind withdrawing them now. If it made sense, I wouldn't mind withdrawing them. Okay.
Additional questions for the commissioner? Do we have any additional testifiers in the audience? Seeing none, Representative Swazinski, would you like to? Okay, 1 second. Representative Scalzi.
It's not a question, it's a comment, I have to admit. But in the delete all, on the lines 1.4 and 5, it says to provide for a stable and predictable regulatory environment for business in this state. I'm thinking, that's the legislature? We're stable and predictable? We are the least stable and predictable body that I'm aware of. And that's why we hire good people. We don't hire people that don't know what they're doing. I haven't heard of any, but we are not stable, and we're not predictable.
Representative Swazinski, any closing comments?
Mr. Chair, committee, I want to thank Representative Scalzi for her comments. As we just move forward this session, we are going to have a lot of bills before us, and I think this is one that, with the comments today, that we have some work to do, and we can look at ways to improve it. And I'd appreciate your support. Minnesota, we're on a new day. We've got jobs to create. We've got businesses to flourish. And I think when we take careful thought and reflection on the things that we do here, I think we'll keep our state in good hands. So I appreciate your thoughts. I appreciate your time, and I'd appreciate your vote on this bill. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. With that, the chair would renew the motion that House File 2211 be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to the Committee on Government Finance. All in favor of the motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Bill does prevail. Do we have any other business? Okay. We have no other business today, so this meeting is adjourned. Everybody have a great Valentine's, and we'll see you tomorrow morning.
You're not.